You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So again, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our event on the structure of the U.S. bond markets. For those of you who might not know me, I'm Doug Elliott from the Economic Studies Program here at Brookings. There are two parts to today's event. First, we'll have a panel on the corporate bond markets, which is moderated by my colleague Martin Bailey. He's a senior fellow here and a former chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. And I'll leave it to him to describe the panel and its participants in a minute. Following that panel, we have two senior officials giving keynote addresses on the Treasury bond market. And I've asked the first panel try not to mention the word Treasuries. So if there's some odd pauses, it's basically so they don't steal any thunder from our two keynotes. The first speaker will be Antonio Weiss, who's counselor to Treasury Secretary Liu, and the second will be Federal Reserve Board Governor Jay Powell, and I'll introduce them more fully when we get to that point in the event. So without further ado, let me turn the podium over to Martin. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to welcome all of you here. And I think we're in for a good session this morning. And I'm just going to quickly introduce the participants and then turn it over to them, and then we'll do a panel. So it seems to be, I'm just simply following my script here, but first is Steve Zamsky. Steve is Managing Director and Head of Global Credit Trading in Morgan Stanley's Fixed Income Division. Second, Annette Nazareth. She's a Davis Polk partner practicing in the firm's financial institutions group in Washington, D.C., and she's a former commissioner of the SEC. Dennis Kelleher is the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, a Washington, D.C.-based independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. That's quite an assignment. And fourth, Kashif Riaz, he's managing director at BlackRock, where he focuses on investment grade credit. Well, that doesn't give our guests justice, but their bios are available to you, so I think we'll move right ahead from there. So now I've lost my TikTok, so let me get to the first speaker, who is Steve Zamsky. Steve, thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody. Martin, thank you for the kind intro, and I guess I've got the warm-up slot here, so we'll try and get things going on a Monday morning. So the question we've been posed is whether there's a structural problem in the corporate bond market, and I guess my reaction to that, and not being immune to the constant press drumbeat on this topic of late, my reaction to that is somewhat more moderate, I suppose, than maybe some might anticipate. I would argue that there's basically been an evolution in place that is creating structural challenges, but to go so far as to say there's some sort of big problem I would view as somewhat extreme, not to say that these issues aren't serious and worthy of discussion and potentially even some change on the regulatory front and otherwise that could help conditions improve to a certain extent. So what is that evolution all about? From my perspective, it's a combination of affairs. There's no one specific cause here that's of the challenges that folks are concerned about. But I think the biggest one would be the combination of regulatory impacts. Again, any one item not being particularly significant, but the combination in their totality certainly having an impact. I also think there's a growth of the market component here. So there's a bit of a numerator and denominator kind of question in terms of the size of the bond market today, as well as the number of participants in the markets today. That's largely an outcome of monetary policy, I suppose, on a certain degree as well. And finally, there's been a change in the composition of the market makers and the asset management industry over time, all of which have changed the market structure that we operate in today. I also think it's important to think of those changes in the context of what the market looks like and how it has always been, how it has always worked from a broad framework perspective, in the sense that it's a very heterogeneous marketplace, very large, a critical place for capital formation, a critical source of capital for corporate America. But it's always had this somewhat illiquid nature to it. So unlike the stock market, where you look at one company and see one ticker and one instrument and understand, have a one instrument that encapsulates the entirety of that part of the company's balance sheet, it's just not that easy in the corporate bond market. It never has been. It wouldn't be uncommon for a specific company to have, you know, tens or dozens or even more bonds. That heterogeneity is kind of just the way it is, and it creates some challenges, but it's also a sign of the incredible flexibility and depth of the market that is a great value to the issuers. Speaking to the size portion of the problem, if you will, the corporate bond market's about three times larger today than it was in the year 2000. That is a very significant rate of growth. That's more than 10% per annum kind of growth, which is an interesting contrast to what the economy's been doing of late, I suppose. But again, I think it's also a sign of success on the monetary policy front on one level, and a sign of success for the issuers who are taking advantage of this robust marketplace. That does present challenges, though. So to the extent that we have a market that's so much bigger than it was before with a smaller number of market makers, to me it has to be the case that that thing would have to be less liquid than it was before. And certainly I think that is how it feels to participants. Whether the data can support that in a robust manner is kind of another question, but certainly market participants would tell you that liquidity is very challenged, if maybe not today, in more of a forward-looking kind of a way. I mentioned some of the regulatory constraints or the impact of the cumulative regulatory constraints. Some of the issues there that have been raised, maybe overemphasized in terms of what I would call kind of the Wall Street Journal version of the story. Again, I'd say it's more the cumulative effect of both the size of the market as well as the regulatory impacts. But it has to be the case, though, that the way we measure capital, the stress testing that's done to banks' balance sheets, the focus on leverage-based capital going forward, as well as the Volcker Rule, the combination of all these actions certainly has impacted the dealer community. It's raised the cost to a certain level, has probably pushed some dealers out of the marketplace. And I think that it is certainly leaves a bit of a question mark in terms of the dealer appetite to engage in market-making activities going forward, at least on a level that would be consistent with the market growth that we've seen. So what's that mean from a current state of play perspective? We have a very large, very heterogeneous marketplace. It has concentrated ownership in terms of the participants as owners of those assets. It has a small number of market makers relative to the historic construct. And as a result, when we look at things like market turnover appears to be lower. I say appears to be lower because trading volumes are actually growing in our marketplace every day, but they aren't growing at the same pace that the market itself is growing. So if one were to define turnover as the amount of trading relative to the size of the market, on that basis, turnover has actually declined. It does appear that we should expect there to be more volatility in this marketplace, as I mentioned, just given the structural evolution. But I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing per se. Historically, there may have been an opportunity or a process by which the dealer community would be a buffer to a certain degree of down trades in the marketplace. Given the limitations I've discussed before, that buffer may no longer exist. I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing. It just means that we may have market disruptions from time to time that are maybe a little bit frightening to a certain degree, but just mean the market gets to the ultimate price in a little quicker fashion than it did in the past, maybe a little bit more economic destruction at the same time. Clearly, the biggest question in all this raises is, what is the outlook for the marketplace in an environment over which rates normalize? Because I would argue that our day-to-day, moment-to-moment business today, that the marketplace works just fine, and that the liquidity, while a challenge for certain players, is nonetheless okay. But the big question is, as rates normalize, if we were to see significant losses in the bond market as a result of that rate normalization, you know, would you see fund outflows that would not be that would be very difficult to intermediate? That's kind of the big question. And would that result in a scenario where, while the Fed's trying to tighten monetary policy in a relatively relatively controlled fashion? Does the market squeeze it in some sort of way that makes it a non-controlled kind of fashion? So to the extent that the Fed's trying to dial in a certain tightening of financial conditions, one could argue that this is a risk that the Fed could kind of lose control over that process. Again, I think that that's certainly a risk. It's probably not a base case, but it's certainly a risk. How does this work out over time? My base case would be that we'll have a situation where transaction costs are higher. We have these bouts of volatility from time to time. That will impact the performance of the largest managers. That will likely lead to some growth of managers who are somewhat more moderate in size and maybe aren't as impacted as significantly by these transaction costs. Those transaction costs should also take the form of bid offer spread for the dealer community. So that should be something that pulls dealers back into the marketplace. So I think that if you look out over a 5 to 7 year kind of time frame, my guess would be that the buy side looks a little bit more balanced in terms of asset ownership, that the dealer community actually grows a bit over time as the bid offer adjusts to reflect the regulatory costs that the dealer community faces these days. That I think is a reasonable estimation on how we get back to something that looks a little bit more like normal. And that, by the way, would look a little bit more like how the industry has looked over long periods of time. Yeah, the question is whether that is a Pollyanna case, and whether there is a more significant risk of a stress kind of outcome than I've kind of laid out here. That gets back to the rate normalization question. That's why market participants are so focused on the pace of rate hikes, because the pace of rate hikes is slow and steady and predictable. These outflows will be manageable and not a significant problem for the marketplace. If, on the other hand, the rates rise more quickly than the market anticipates, that's when we'll be forced to consider and play out day to day how these stresses actually go through the system. And again, that gets into the question of the cost and availability of capital. I do think there are some tweaks that are possible to pursue that could help the liquidity conditions in the marketplace today. I think that better hedging tools would be something that, if adopted by both the buy side and the sell side, could help us manage our risk more effectively day to day. That should help liquidity on the margin. There's lots of moves afront on that topic in the industry today, and I think that will be a source of some improvement in market efficiency going forward. I do think there's opportunities to tweak the trade reporting process in the corporate bond market that could allow market makers to be better intermediators of large-scale risk transfer. That's something you've seen a bit about in the press, and I think is, in my view, really not that controversial and something that could help market liquidity day to day. And finally, there's the topic of the homogenization of issuance. As I mentioned before, the corporate bond market suffers to some extent from a massive degree of heterogeneity. I don't think that's really going to change for the most part. The issuers, value significantly their ability to be flexible about issuance and access the incredible breadth and depth that's in our marketplace today. But that's not to say that there's not a few opportunities around homogenization. So could we see more reopenings of bond issues? Could we pursue other vehicles that could be hedges for market participants on a single company kind of basis? There's some efforts underway in the industry today that I think could make some progress on that. So I do think that none of these things that I mentioned is going to massively change the marketplace and its environment. I would argue that each could have a positive impact, and maybe the sum total of those small impacts would be something that would be measurable in terms of liquidity. So in the interest of time, I'll wrap it up as my intro and pass it on to our next speaker.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I want to thank in particular Brookings and Martin Bailey and Doug Elliott for inviting me to speak today on this very interesting and timely topic. As Martin said, I'm a former SEC commissioner. I was also the director of the Division of Trading and Markets, and so my views today very much reflect my perspective as a former regulator and a person who has had a keen interest in following market structure issues. Given the size and importance of the fixed income markets, it's really somewhat surprising how immune this asset class has been to the forces that brought about such significant market structure changes in other asset classes over the past several years. It appears that really a disproportionate amount of regulatory attention and public focus has been devoted to the equity markets and the swaps markets, while comparatively little was devoted to the fixed income markets. In the equity markets, we've seen very significant evolution in the last 10 to 15 years, as you know, from a very small number of floor-based markets to multiple competing electronic platforms that provide investors with a large array of trading execution alternatives. The equity markets provide pre- and post-trade pricing data to the marketplace that provides investors with the information they need to trade on an informed basis. Competition among market centers is very robust and has resulted in significant reductions in execution costs. There's also been a notable evolution in the types of entities that participate in these automated trading venues and who provide liquidity to the markets. Regulators have focused, as you know, on the emergence of high-frequency trading firms and the reduction in the traditional dealer market maker activity and its possible effects on liquidity in times of stress, and whether any regulatory responses in that area are warranted. We've certainly also seen tectonic shifts in the swaps market post-Dodd-Frank, as that legislation mandated that the swaps market move from a largely unregulated multi-trillion dollar market to a pervasively regulated market with many products subject to, or soon to be subject to, mandatory clearing requirements and requirements to trade on exchanges or electronic platforms known as swap execution facilities that are open to non-dealers. There also has been meaningful progress in price transparency in the swaps market, and thus the market structure for both equities and swaps has become more competitive and less concentrated among a small group of market players. And technology has played a very important factor in driving change in both those markets. But the fixed income market has been much slower to evolve, even as that market continues to grow in size and importance in the U.S. economy. Indeed, U.S. corporate bond issuances in 2014 alone exceeded $1 trillion. So our topic today is whether there are structural issues in the U.S. bond markets. So I think to begin to answer that question, you really need to understand the current fixed income market structure, particularly in comparison to that of other markets. Compared to the equity and swaps markets, and on an absolute basis, the corporate bond market is relatively illiquid. There are more than 40,000 corporate bond issues totaling approximately $11.3 trillion in principal amount outstanding. And there, as we've heard from our previous speaker, very little standardization in bond terms. Studies of trace data for corporate bonds have indicated that very generally, only about 20% of those bonds trade every day, and nearly 18% barely trade at all. One study showed that the median number of trades for a sample 30-day period was approximately 14, which means that bonds in the middle of the pack might trade once every 2 days. While generally about two-thirds of all trades are retail and one-third are institutional trades represent almost 95% of the volume in terms of the principal amount of bonds traded. This would suggest that large players may have a need for greater liquidity and overall size for their transactions. And a handful of dealers account for about a third of all trading in corporate bonds. This market remains overwhelmingly decentralized. Over-the-counter, bilateral, and a dealer-based principal as opposed to agency market. There is some bond trading on exchanges. Specifically, there are some bonds that trade on the New York Stock Exchange, but volumes are not material, and 95% of the trades on that market are retail and trade in smaller size. The municipal bond market has a similar market structure, with bond dealers affecting virtually all transactions over the counter on a riskless principal basis. And the number, which is $3.7 trillion in principal amount outstanding, and the individualized terms of these municipal issuances are also comparable to the corporate bond market. We really have to look back as far as 2002 to see the most important change in the fixed income markets in the last 15 years, and that was the implementation of the TRACE system, which was an SEC set of approved FINRA rules that mandated post-trade price reporting for corporate bonds. This change, not surprisingly, was rather hard fought. As you undoubtedly know, intermediaries such as dealers benefited from the opacity, and thus the dealers strongly opposed the SEC and FINRA price transparency reforms. There were certainly some legitimate issues raised concerning the liquidity impact of trade reporting, but economic analysis conducted by the SEC showed that liquidity did not suffer materially under the FINRA proposal during the rule's rollout period. What studies did show after the implementation, however, was that spreads narrowed as a result of this mandated price transparency, and thus investors benefited from more competitive pricing. Notwithstanding the transparency that we see post-trade that was achieved by FINRA's TRACE system for corporate bonds and later the MSRB's EMMA system for municipal bonds, the markups that are charged in these principal transactions with dealers remain largely opaque. Both FINRA and the MSRB have recently been encouraged by the SEC to mandate disclosure of pricing information for same-day retail-size principal transactions for corporate and agency debt securities, as well as municipal securities, so that investors have a frame of reference for assessing the markup. So the takeaway message on the structure of the bond markets is that notwithstanding the profound impact that technology has had on competition and intermediation in markets such as the equity and swaps markets, the fixed income markets, and particularly the corporate and municipal bond markets, remain largely manual and dealer-centric, with a large number of separate CUSIPs, each with bespoke attributes. There's very little movement towards more electronic platforms that permit non-dealers, such as high-frequency traders or buy-side firms, to participate. And the number and complexity of the bond issues also make continuous auction-based electronic markets less attractive. There's been much concern expressed of late about liquidity issues in the fixed income markets. Dealers have traditionally held sizable inventories in the corporate and municipal bonds in which they make markets. It is widely believed that these dealer inventories are materially lower than they've been in the past. Investors, particularly large institutional investors such as mutual funds and pension funds, are concerned about the impact this change will have on their ability to trade in and out of their positions. The anticipated rise in interest rates by the Fed and the likelihood of the need for liquidity in the face of selling pressure has exacerbated these concerns. Many have speculated on the causes for the reduction in dealer inventories. While some point to reductions in inventories that began prior to the Dodd-Frank Act, recent regulatory changes have likely contributed to this occurrence, including the Volcker Rule's prohibition on proprietary trading by banks. Higher capital requirements likely also make holding fixed income positions more costly. And some believe that banks have reduced their inventories as they have moved to significantly increase the liquidity of their balance sheets as part of the resolution planning process. To be sure, ensuring that large financial institutions are resilient is an important regulatory goal, and there may well be reasons other than these regulatory initiatives that are contributing to these changes. But regardless of the causes, the vulnerabilities of the fixed income market structure and the apparent reduction in dealer inventories is a growing concern. As you know, there's also been a great deal of concern about the structural issues and liquidity in the U.S. Treasury market after the events of October 15, 2014, when the market for U.S. Treasury securities and other closely related markets experienced unusually significant volatility. Unlike the corporate and municipal markets, the Treasury market has seen more structural change, including changes in intermediation, automated trading, regulation, and participation by non-dealers, including high-frequency trading firms, on electronic platforms. The growth of electronic trading of Treasury securities changed the composition of participants in the market over time. HFTs gained access to the platforms by the mid-2000s and now represent more than half of the trading activity in those products. The participation of high-frequency traders in the Treasury market may have changed the way trading occurs and the way liquidity is provided on these markets that is not yet fully understood. The expansion of electronic trading and new participants on the platforms increased competitive pressures, just as occurred in the equity markets more than a decade ago. As spreads narrow, dealers may be less inclined to engage in this activity versus other more profitable activities. And as with the corporate and municipal activities, regulatory changes may have increased trading and inventory costs and provided disincentives to make markets in Treasury securities. There will undoubtedly be further regulatory action and study following on the heels of the joint Treasury staff Treasury market report. I note that one action item seems remarkably overdue for this market, particularly one of this size and importance, and that's that the staffs will conduct an assessment of the sufficiency of publicly available information on Treasury securities pricing and pre- and post-trade trading activity. This is a critical first step, and one that I predict will be implemented very promptly, with additional analysis to follow on whether further reforms in the Treasury markets are needed.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you to Brookings and Doug and Martin for inviting me and having me here. You all get extra credit. It's a Monday in August morning, and you're here to talk about liquidity. As is often the case, I'm invited to be slightly more provocative than most people on these subjects. So we're going to get right to there's a lot of things to say, and there's a lot of facts that don't often get mentioned. So I thought I'd do something radical and start with a few facts. First, and Steve alluded to this a little bit, there really is a liquidity hysteria going on at the moment. So the first fact to begin with is there's zero actual evidence of financial regulation is causing any liquidity problems. And in fact, the evidence shows the opposite. History shows that volatility increases when the Fed normalizes policies, i.e. changes rates, especially when they increase. If you look at history, when they increase, volatility really goes up. Everyone knows the Fed's preparing to normalize rates. So after you have a historic crash, an economic crisis, all of this comes on top of years of unprecedented rate actions plus bond buying, both of which add to uncertainty. Also, the Fed policy has dominated investment and trading decisions, thereby exaggerating the historical patterns. As we've seen, there's a tremendous amount of herding going on. So the Fed isn't the only reason for changes in the liquidity, as Steve alluded to. There's massive shifts to gigantic asset managers, there's historical high bond issuances, there's electronic HFT activities, and a lot more going on in these markets that might have something to do with liquidity. The decrease in Wall Street dealer bond inventory has been grossly exaggerated. Wall Street dealer banks never had much inventory to begin with, and much of what they did have pre-crisis was illusory or phantom toxic products. There was also, interestingly, no golden age of liquidity when everyone could trade at all times at the price and size they wanted, as so many of today's claims seem to suggest. Wall Street's dealer banks are not beneficent market makers standing ready at all times to buy and sell to maintain an orderly market regardless of volatility. Wall Street's dealers aren't shock absorbers. They are opportunistic and at times predatory buyers, but are mostly shock creators and amplifiers. Thus, Wall Street dealer banks and their allies have created a false crisis and then created a false culprit, financial regulations, but the facts show otherwise. Now, let's start with just one of the facts, and as Doug requested, to not be too inflammatory, I thought I'd start with Jamie Dimon is wrong. Wall Street dealer inventories of corporate bonds are not down 75%, as he said in his April 8, 2015 letter to shareholders, which I quote here. This is a report from Goldman Sachs. Unfortunately, our colleague from Goldman Sachs couldn't make it today, so I thought I would vicariously bring Goldman Sachs to the briefing. This is a quote from a Goldman Sachs report from October of 2014. We also think the decline in dealer corporate bond inventories has been exaggerated. Why? Because the primary dealer net positions in corporate securities that is used for that includes a definition in the definition of corporate securities. They include private label mortgage-backed securities in addition to the plain vanilla corporate bonds, which overstates the magnitude of the decline. This isn't me. This is Goldman Sachs. As you can see from this Goldman Sachs chart, if you look at the top chart, that's what a lot of people refer to. But that is not corporate bonds. That includes the private label mortgage-backed securities. If you strip those out, what you have is the line on the bottom. And what does that show? That shows a little decline, but not much decline, in so-called dealer inventories of corporate bonds. So sure, it's down, but it's not a 75% drop. Also importantly, though, note that the data shows that the current inventories of corporate bonds are not far off from the range of inventories from 2002 to 2005. Thus, if dealer inventories look much like they did in the period before the financial crisis, then the claim that post-crisis regulations have impacted, never mind dried up, those inventories has to be false. This, too, is from the Goldman report, and I know you would love me to take you through this in detail, but I'm not going to. So there's another issue, which is Wall Street's dealers never had that much inventory to begin with. They only had a tiny fraction of the outstanding corporate bond market, and therefore it's kind of hard to argue they're shock absorbers. This shows the dealer inventory of corporate bonds as a percentage of total outstanding in 2006. 0.7% of 1% was their inventory of all outstanding bonds. It's kind of hard to be a shock absorber when you don't have anything to absorb. Add that to the fact that much of the pre-crisis dealer inventories were illusory. Inventories were bloated with toxic, often worthless securities that had to be written off or marked down to reflect their market prices. Thus, it's not bad to have less liquidity of and for bad, toxic, or illusory trading and investments which fueled the last crash and crisis. And IOSCO did an interesting study that's pretty comprehensive that showed the drop in Wall Street dealer inventories merely getting rid of illusory or phantom liquidity. I won't go into that, but you should read it. IOSCO did a great report. Now, there's another way to look at this. I know you know this guy, the former Citigroup CEO. When the music stops, in terms of liquidity, people always drop that phrase when they quote him. Things will be complicated, but as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance, and we're still dancing in 2007. Well, of course, we know in 2008, Citigroup was one of the biggest, most reckless failures of the financial crash, received the biggest bailout of any single institution, $476.2 billion from a series of rescue programs, and not for nothing, the only Wall Street bank that didn't repay the money it received from the TARP program. Or as Andy Haldane would say, the result is a periodic tidal wave of credit, i.e. liquidity, during the boom, followed by protracted credit drought during the crunch. Chuck Prince's Disco Inferno causes murder on the dance floor. Leave it to Andy. The myth of Wall Street dealer banks as market makers don't withstand scrutiny either. There never was a golden age of liquidity when you all get to trade at the price and the size and the time you'd like. That's because Wall Street dealers aren't beneficent market makers. And that's also why they aren't shock absorbers, and it is why they are shock amplifiers and magnifiers. And Wall Street's dealers' trading shows that it's not regulation that's inhibiting trading. So, again, Goldman Sachs will make an appearance in my presentation. This is a Goldman Sachs trader who actually participated in a terrific committee hearing at the CFTC. Commissioner Sharon Bowen held a committee hearing on June 2nd, and I would encourage all of you who care about this issue to go back and watch it or read the transcript. It's fascinating, with many market participants talking and discussing these issues over about 2 hours. But this is what a Goldman Sachs trader had to say. Liquidity does not sit alongside life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence. Liquidity provision is, at the end of the day, a service which needs to earn an economic rate of return. No shock. Well, why are these myths about liquidity increasingly prevalent and strident? Well, as Ken Griffin said in the Wall Street Journal, historically, Wall Street banks have enjoyed a privileged position as intermediaries between buyers and sellers in the fixed income market. Unsurprisingly, these banks argue that their position must be maintained to facilitate liquidity during volatile periods. This is a myth intended to preserve their competitive moat around what has been a very lucrative business. Now, I should say much of the rest of the op-ed was pretty dubious, and Themis Trading at themistrading.com has a blog that goes through the rest of it. But this point, he's right on, and this gets a little bit to what Annette had to say when they tried to bring in Trace, and the sky was going to fall, and all sorts of bad things were going to happen. But lo and behold, it didn't happen. Actually, margins were crushed, which means their business was trusted, diversified the market, there was more transparency, a level playing field, and it improved the markets overall. Again, the Goldman Sachs trader. I feel like sometimes I hear some of the comments, and it feels like liquidity is this magical thing that's going to keep everybody from losing money. I've never traded in a market where that's the case. That's why trading dried up during high volatility. That's why trading drying up during high volatility is the norm, as was observed in 1994, 1998, and 2008, when there were none of the so-called restrictions on Wall Street dealer banks like today. So here's another one that's pretty interesting. No liquidity provider who's economically rational is going to stand there and provide continuous liquidity in the face of new information which changes the fair value of an asset, and I think that needs to be recognized. I would have gotten fired, says the Goldman Sachs trader, correctly, so fast if the market was selling off and all I did was sit there and buy from customers. In the face of new information, i.e. the Fed moving on interest rates, markets reprice. You can't avoid that. That's trading. Losing money in that situation is not no liquidity. You have a bad trade on. The role of a market maker is not to stand in the way of a one-way freight train where you know where it's going. Another way to put it is any problem we have in the bond markets won't be solved by higher dealer inventories or lower capital requirements. And that's the point that the Goldman Sachs trader and all the other traders and market participants made at the CFTC committee meeting. Even without regulation, it's unclear whether dealer banks would want to step in during heavy one-way selling because, despite what many people think of the big banks, these people generally aren't idiots. And finally, during a sell-off, perhaps triggered by a change in sentiment of bad news, dealers did not simply buy bonds to buffer the markets. They would buy attractive bonds opportunistically, but also quite likely would contribute to the sell-off by trying to lighten their inventory. Hence, the buffer claim implies that dealers were fulfilling some form of public service. Dealers may not always do smart things or have the right view about the market, but they tend not to mix business with charity. And of course, no surprise, that's exactly what was observed during the trading of Wall Street's dealer banks during the so-called temper tantrum. But per Doug's edict, I'm not going to get into treasuries. I will just say that that was demonstrated in the Federal Reserve study and in an FSOC study, but I won't refer to treasuries because I was told I'll get tasered if I do. All right, so where does that leave us? First, make no mistake about it. When the Fed raises rates, volatility is going to go way up and people are going to lose money. Some people are going to lose lots of money. I don't know if you remember, but in 1994, the year of the bond market debacle, there were blow-ups across the country from Ascon Capital Management to SWIB to Orange County to Gibson Greetings to P&G to Bankers Trust. But investors losing money or even blowing themselves up is not a liquidity problem. It is no basis to change financial regulation targeted at illusory liquidity while making the financial system stronger and more resilient. The real issues are risk and risk management, not regulation. The other issue is who pays for liquidity and the associated risk. It's investors or taxpayers. Financial reform has shifted those risks and costs back to investors. And indeed, many prominent market participants, Peter Fisher included among others, have noted that this may actually get investors back into investing rather than trading. But it shifted the risk and cost back to investors and away from taxpayers who ended up on the hook for Wall Street's dealer banks' reckless actions last time. The new rules are designed to ensure that liquidity will be priced at its true cost, not underpriced to reflect government and taxpayer subsidies in the form of underregulation, Fed emergency liquidity facilities, and at the end of the day, taxpayer bailouts. So Greg Ford from Finance Watch, based out of Brussels, had this to say, the financial industry lobbyists are using concerns about market liquidity to try and scare policymakers away from necessary reforms to bank structure and capital. If policymakers react in the wrong way to the liquidity lobbying, they'll risk leaving us with more short-term investing and a financial system that is more fragile and pro-cyclical than it needs to be. And that means that it needs to be for all of us. As Mark Carney said, more expensive liquidity is a price well worth paying for making the core of the system more robust. Removing public subsidies is absolutely necessary for real markets to exist. Or, the Goldman Sachs trader, put simply, you could argue, I think correctly, that the liquidity that was observed pre-crisis was subsidized by the taxpayer. In our view, it would be a mistake to roll back those reforms for the sake of recreating the same set of issues. So what's at stake in trying to roll back reform? Well, another financial crash and economic calamity. 2008 was the worst financial crash since the Great Depression of 1929. It caused the worst economy since the Great Crash of 1929. It caused the worst economy since the Great Depression of the 1930s. As detailed in a report by Better Markets, all of that's going to cost this country about $20 trillion. The American people have suffered too much. No one, especially Wall Street CEOs, should be advocating for a return to the 2007 peaks of anything. So I will leave you with this thought. We actually at Better Markets did a report on the cost of the crisis that we just put out on the fifth anniversary of Dodd-Frank to remind people that the anniversary is actually a recognition of what happened years before in 2008, 9, and 10. And in order to talk about regulation or the risk of rolling back regulation, we should focus on the cost of non-regulation, under-regulation, and taxpayer bailouts. And too often, that's what underlies the discussion about what we call the current liquidity hysteria. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you. And before I start, I just want to set your expectations that it might be a bit drier than the previous speaker. So on behalf of BlackRock, thank you very much to the Brookings Institution for the invitation today and for the opportunity to have this discussion. This is obviously market structure and liquidity in the credit markets is a very important topic, and we've spent a great deal of time at BlackRock over the past few years examining these issues across the various parts of our firm, and have also engaged in a broad dialogue with peers, counterparties, regulators, and other stakeholders. Before getting into the details of a few suggestions and recommendations we've developed, I wanted to spend a little bit of time recapping, in our view, what are some of the factors that have driven the changed liquidity environment. So many of the points I made will be similar to the previous speaker, so I think it's encouraging to see that on the major themes there is a remarkably broad consensus that's developed. And it's separate from what I think accurately has been described by some of the others as probably an overheated debate in the media on the topic. So first of all, I do think it's very important to point out that the growth in the fixed income markets and specifically in the credit markets over the last several years is a very important factor. We've seen growth driven by both really the supply and demand sides of the market. On the supply side of the market, there's a tremendous amount of capital formation taking place where corporate borrowers really from across the world are coming to the U.S. credit markets to fund investments and operations. That's driven by the low rate environment that's prompting them to refinance their capital structures and to make new investments. On the demand side of the market, global investors are flush with savings and have increased the assets dedicated to credit markets. So both those factors and obviously monetary policy and the economic cycle plays a part in that growth that we've seen over the past in the post-crisis period. Secondly, the changes in the over-the-counter market makers' risk appetites that have occurred since the crisis are an important factor in the new environment. Traditionally, as we all know, the credit market making credit has been an over-the-counter principal function. With the growth in the market happening at the same time as many of these companies changing their business models post-financial crisis, that has had an impact. And those changes in business model are not simply a result of or a reaction to new regulations, whether Basel III or Dodd-Frank. I do think that the large financial firms learned a lot about their business models during the crisis, about appropriate levels of leverage in various businesses, about the actual returns on capital in different lines of business. And as multi-line businesses, what you've seen is that credit market making and fixed income market making more broadly is generally a lower return business than many of the other activities that global banks engage in. So as a result, the dealer balance sheets are certainly not growing. Regulatory changes aimed at enhancing capital and liquidity at the banks and ensuring a safer and more sound broader financial system have had an impact in our view as well. And finally, I will agree with some of the previous speakers that the pre-crisis liquidity conditions, which were fueled by leverage, were neither healthy nor sustainable. So looking ahead, we do think that it's important for the market to look at the current state of play and think about the modernization of the market structure to cope with the new size of the fixed income market and the new reality, both in terms of regulation and in terms of essentially the business models of the various constituents in the market. Finally, while liquidity has gotten a lot of attention over the last year or so, I do think it's important to highlight that liquidity risk is not something new. It's been an inherent part of portfolio management since the inception and professionalization of the industry. It's something that portfolio managers and risk managers have looked at for a long time. And liquidity risk is both a risk and an opportunity. There are certain assets that will always be illiquid. They're designed to be such. And for investors with the appropriately long time horizons and risk tolerances, they're actually illiquidity can create interesting investment opportunities. The mismatch is what causes the problem between expectations and reality. Before going further, I do want to just delve upon the term liquidity for a moment. It gets used in a lot of different contexts, but the context we're referring to it today is that of where liquidity can be defined as essentially market depth or capacity and the ability to buy or sell a certain quantum of securities without materially causing changes to the market price of the asset. Obviously, there's other discussions of liquidity, whether it's talking about central bank liquidity or fund level liquidity, which has also been a topic that's been getting some attention as of late. So when we look at the broad question of market structure in fixed income, and this has been something we've recently published in a couple of publicly available viewpoints, we're advocates of what we call now a three-pronged approach. The first one of those prongs is broadly under the category of market structure modernization. And our overarching observation here is that given the size of the global credit markets, that the traditional OTC principal intermediated market structure is increasingly out of date and needs to adapt. In addition, we do think that the adoption of technology by the credit markets has been much slower than in many adjacent securities markets, whether it's equities, futures, swaps, or others, and that we are, I think, seeing real time a fair bit of ferment and a fair bit of activity where technology is coming to the credit markets, not just as what it's been so far, a productivity improvement, but actual process innovations. And we think that'll have a material impact in years to come. Other elements of our three prongs, in addition to market structure modernization, are enhancing fund and product level disclosure so that there is a very clear understanding by end investors of what are the liquidity management practices and risks of specific fund products, whether they're mutual funds, ETFs, or other. And thirdly, we do think that as markets evolve, investment products evolve too, and that there are products and innovations that can occur to allow end investors to access the credit markets in a way that's suited for purpose. So I'll go a little deeper into each of those in the next few minutes. As I've already talked about, the current environment has been driven by the mix of very rapid growth in the credit markets, the fuel of monetary policy, which we all understand is poised to change. And I do think an important point has been made earlier, and we would echo it, which is that there is a difference between investment risk and systemic risk. Just because the prices of bonds go down as rates go up doesn't mean that there's a systemic risk. That's a regular part of market cycles. I think the question that we should look at in the context of market structure and its impact on systemic risk is, are there issues in market structure that can cause such a severe backup in the plumbing of the market so as to, in and of itself, cause feedback effects that then become unpredictable? So I think that's the narrow question to look at. Obviously, bond prices will go up and down as market conditions change. I'll spend a couple minutes on our specific recommendations on market structure modernization. I talked a little bit generally about greater use of technology. Specifically, we do think that given the limitations on growth of dealer balance sheets and the limitations of the traditional OTC market making function in light of the size of the fixed income market, we do advocate exploring and using more all-to-all trading venues. And what we mean by that is simply that where buyers, sellers, and other market participants can, whether it's an exchange or an electronic platform, have the opportunity for there to be more connections rather than the bilateral dealer-client connection. The opportunity for more connections, we are hopeful can uncover some heretofore latent liquidity, and technology has a very important role in that. We do think that the heterogeneity of the credit markets is a important constraining factor. I think it's important to level set expectations and understand that corporate bonds are never going to be as liquid as single equities or as single FX pairs or defined futures contracts. But there are a number of incremental steps that can improve the status quo. Greater use of large liquid benchmark issues is one of those steps. When issuers are given clear price signals where liquid assets are priced better to them than illiquid assets, then we do think issuer behavior can shift over time. But right now, the market is not giving those signals. Another point I would make is that we do think it's important for market participants to adapt their historical behavior and expectations. One simple example of that is buy-side participants such as ourselves need to become more comfortable being price makers, not market makers, but price makers, meaning that we can show a price at which we're willing to transact, which in a way increases the information, the pricing information available to the market and for dealers to react to. Another topic, TRACE was covered by some of the other participants. We do think that TRACE in general has worked well in improving price transparency. We do think that in an existing illiquid market, for example, the market for large block trades, the TRACE reporting thresholds have the ability to actually inhibit liquidity rather than create it. So we do think it is worthwhile to revisit some of the reporting thresholds, et cetera, so that the large block trading doesn't have a dampening effect because in the way that TRACE currently works. So the common themes that I'm making in these topics about market structure modernization are essentially for the market to use emerging technologies better that have already been well applied in other securities markets, and taking steps that collectively reduce the capital intensity of fixed income market making and make it a bit more of an information-intensive business rather than a capital-intensive business. And in closing, I do think that this is a very important topic. I think that market structure and liquidity their impact has been masked for some time because of very strong credit market conditions. And like any market which is subject to cycles, as those market conditions are on the threshold of change, it's worthwhile to have this discussion about how the market structure can react in coming years as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you to our participants for really interesting presentations. I would normally be sitting with them down there, but under Brookings rules, we are only allowed four people on the stage. This gives you a glimpse of the Brookings rules at work. We will. I'm here at the podium, so that gives me a certain height here, height advantage. Okay, I'm still on because everybody's getting mic'd up. Are we all mic'd up? Okay, so let me start with a sort of general question, and that is, I think it's been raised by many of the speakers, which is that new technologies have revolutionized other parts of financial markets, particularly equities and swaps and so on, but these changes do not seem to have had the same impact on the fixed income markets. So I'll pick on you first, Annette. Why do you think that's the case? What is it that's holding it up?
Well, I think partly it's not in the dealer's interest, right, to have these sort of open, flat platforms.
So you think there's backward pressure coming from?
I think there's a little bit of backward pressure. I'd be interested in what others think, but I've assumed that that's certainly part of it. Even in those circumstances, interestingly, where we see some use of automation, it's tended to be just replicating electronically what is the current dealer model, where on the system itself you have principal transactions. It's just making it more efficient to communicate. So it does seem, in my case, to be really quite incremental, and it seems to me that it may have something to do with the incentives.
Okay. So, Steve, do you want to respond to that? Are you guys pushing back?
Well, we seem to do it in every other market, so I don't know why we would push back in corporate credit. I think that there's a little bit of a cause and effect thing. So people observe the liquidity. They observe the equity market. They observe the FX market. They observe the treasury market, and they say, hey, these markets have a lot of liquidity and a lot of transparency and trade electronically, and that stuff must all be interrelated. And it is all interrelated, but I think there's a question of cause and effect. So to me, if you look at the equity market, FX, and rates, these are markets that have a high degree of homogeneity, have a lot of breadth, and have a lot of depth. So just by their very characteristics, you'd expect them to be traded electronically and very easily. In credit, we don't have that. We have exactly the opposite. So we have a very heterogeneous market. We have depth, I guess, in terms of size, but not size at a price. And one could question the breadth, particularly given how the markets become more concentrated over time. The one contrast in credit is, of course, the credit index markets, the CDX markets, which even before the implementation of CEF had already gone fully electronic because they do have those characteristics that make them easy to trade electronically. So I'll battle back against or push back against dealer conspiracy and argue for just the nature of the instruments themselves and how easy they are to adapt to the market. I'm not sure people need to trade every single one of those 40,000 CUSIPs 20 times a day, 100 times a day, 1,000 times a day. That's not what those instruments were for. And these are largely instruments held by liability hedgers and people saving for their retirement. I'm not sure we need these to trade in a highly frequent manner, nor is the nature of the instruments themselves likely to be conducive to trading electronically. That's not to say that we don't care about those initiatives. We're very engaged in electronic trading. There are opportunities on the margin for sure. Particularly around efficiency of some of the most liquid instruments. We want to engage and do engage with our client base that way all day, every day. But in terms of the real opportunity that to change the market and its liquidity and depth overall, I think that that's going to be a real, real challenge over time. I think that, again, there's an efficiency opportunity, but who's to say that's to create liquidity? You don't create liquidity out of thin air. So, I think we're kind of, from my own perspective, if we think there's a liquidity problem, and as several of us have said, there's a kind of a question whether there really is a liquidity problem. But if we think there is a liquidity problem, I kind of think our energies are probably spent better elsewhere in trying to think about some of the real causes.
Okay. Kashif, do you have a sense of why markets are behind, which you also described?
Absolutely. I think one of the reasons the credit markets are behind in process changes driven by technology is because to date the status quo has largely worked to meet the needs of market participants. So as Steve said, the demand for liquidity isn't as high as it is in equities, for example, which is a much more retail-heavy market. In addition, the size of the dealer balance sheets and the OTC intermediating function until recently worked pretty well. And one of the reasons why this topic has gained increasing attention over the last couple of years is maybe it's not working so well anymore as the market has grown. Those are some of the reasons. In addition, the heterogeneity is a very important reason that undoubtedly the structure of cash credit products is more complex and heterogeneous than most other securities markets, so it's a much harder problem to solve. So in terms of the type of technology systems and algorithms that can effectively cause real fundamental process changes, they're probably just now coming into full bloom and becoming fit for the kind of large-scale, reliable, robust system that's needed for an institutional market of this size.
Dennis, let me address a question to you. Now, under the regulatory rules, let me back off a minute. So if you are a relatively small company, so you're not an IBM or a Microsoft or something like that, under the old world, the dealer would hold an inventory of your bonds and then gradually sell them off over time. So this was the way they would make the market for something that wasn't a household name, that wasn't something that was going to be snapped up immediately it was issued. Now, a lot of people think that Volcker and other aspects, the capital requirements, liquidity requirements, have made that more costly or even made it difficult for the dealers to do that, the broker-dealers to do that. And so they've reduced their inventory, and I think you quoted Goldman Sachs, but I could also quote Goldman Sachs as saying that's reduced the amount of liquidity, and it's hitting small companies and raising their cost of capital. So you dismissed this whole problem. I don't have a horse here in this race exactly, but what's your response to that? I mean, wouldn't we have expected this regulation?
I don't think I dismissed the problem, but I first want to go back to something that Steve said. Okay. You don't have to believe that the current state of the market, the fixed income markets and the way they trade, as Annette alluded to them, is due to a dealer conspiracy. The dealers are reacting to incentives. They have a massive amount of this business, which means a massive amount of revenue and profits. And they are, as Ken Griffin said earlier, attempting to protect their market position. And that does not mean transparency, a level playing field, and making it easier for other entrants into the markets. So there's an incumbent protection action going on that you would expect in any market, in any area where you have an oligopoly or a small group of people that control the market in many respects. So there's nothing to do with conspiracy or perfidious conduct. It's like I say, well, somebody's talking their book, and they say that's bad. I say, no, you should expect people to talk their book, right? You just should recognize it as talking their book. And I'm not talking about you. I'm just talking about the broader question. So it's not a conspiracy, non-conspiracy. You have to look at the facts, how people act in the market, how they react into the incentives, and then you have to look at the overlay of the laws and regulation as to what is permitted. And if you're permitted to do that and extract rents, and that's your book, you would do it. All right? And so, and that's the context that Annette alludes to. It's the same thing when you get back to TRACE and the fight against putting TRACE in a place. We've got the same problem. We've tried to have electronic markets and changes to the fixed income markets so that you make it level playing field, more transparency, easier for entrants to come in, greater competition for the incumbents. As to your question, I don't dismiss regulation across the board. And in fact, I would argue, and I think people have, that much of the regulation has driven out what is, I think, admitted to be, and as everybody, I think, would admit, was some illusory inventory based on...
I'm talking about corporate bonds.
I understand.
Corporate bonds.
But you
We're
said
not
I,
talking about the...
Wait a minute. But you said
CEOs
said
and all the stuff that
I heard
got
you.
Into trouble.
I heard you, but you said I dismissed everything, and that's not accurate, okay? So that's point number one. Point number two is if you look at the breakdown, if you disaggregate the inventories over time, the so-called problem in liquidity for the inventories in terms of a significant issue has never been in the small corporate issuances. So you have the underwriting going on, but when you look at the inventories and the normalized actual corporate bond inventories, those inventories are not comprised of small issuers. They're just not. They're a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction of the inventories. So I've heard that, but it reminds me when I say, oh, we need to change the Volcker rule because it's hurting community banks. But it's not hurting community banks, and we know that. It's hurting the big banks. And so people say, oh, look, it's hurting liquidity in these small issuers because they can't hold the inventory. But the facts show they didn't have the inventory before. So it can't be hurting them now. So it's kind of whack-a-mole where you have this, you want to change the rules, which disproportionately benefit the dealer banks by claiming you're worried about small issuers. But the facts don't bear that out on the inventory, either currently or over time.
Okay. Let me go back to you, Annette. I don't know if you want to respond to that. But also, looking back in your former role at the SEC, would you recommend changes that the SEC or regulators might be able to make in these markets, in these fixed income markets, to improve the way they operate? But if you want to respond to the other members on your panel, feel free to do that.
Well, one thing I want to be clear, I'm certainly not talking about a conspiracy, but I do think that there was also very little incentive in the past, given how well the markets were functioning, as Steve said, that we really didn't have the need to, to innovate as we may now. And I do think that the heterogeneity of the products really made automated trading less viable. I mean, there were attempts at it, and you can have all of these messages in a system, but if there's not enough activity in the system, because as you said, these products trade so infrequently, it's not really viable. I think what we see now is potentially an opportunity to revisit some of these things, both greater standardization, perhaps encouraging greater standardization of products, encouraging greater use of automation. Exactly what role regulation can play in that, I'm not sure. I don't think you'd want to necessarily, I'm not sure we're at the point where we would mandate it, but I do think that there are, there may be sort of industry initiatives that could make progress in some of these areas.
Anybody want to add on to that, or I'll move on? Do you think you had some recommendations? Do they involve regulatory changes, or is this more an industry initiative?
Largely, they are industry initiatives. Obviously, we do think that what's warranted is a broad discussion amongst all stakeholders. That includes regulators, and there may be some important steps for them. But some of the most impactful steps are, clearly either buy side or dealer driven, as well as technology infrastructure providers, exchange providers, et cetera. And I would underline one of the points I made earlier, which is that in isolation, this is a very complex issue. In isolation, any single step can quite easily be dismissed as being of very modest consequence. And so you kind of need a half dozen or so separate reforms and developments over the course of time to gradually evolve the market.
Steve, let me ask you to take a little bit more of a global perspective so that I think it was you, maybe it was someone else mentioned that issuers from all around the world are coming to the United States to issue. Now, that reflects the fact that we have, we're large, we have a lot of depth. Is your sense that that's increasing? Is the United States or the sort of New York markets becoming more important globally, or has regulation, in fact, made us less competitive and eventually we're going to see some of that business go overseas?
This time I'm not going to use the word conspiracy, so I was going to take it out of context. I was kidding, folks. Look, the U.S. markets have long been an important source of capital for foreign companies. You see that in issuance trends, and that's been the case for a long, long period of time. I think it would be inaccurate to say that these regulatory changes have had any negative impact there. You do see, for example, going the other way a little bit, there's been an enormous amount of issuance by U.S. companies in Europe this year, and that's largely been a response to price as opposed to anything else. So QE in Europe has had a significant impact on corporate credit spreads there. So we've seen U.S. issuers flock to take advantage of that. So someone could look at the data and maybe try and argue something given kind of this relative geographic preference that issuers seem to be demonstrating, but I don't think that's a factor. I think if you were looking for those kinds of impacts in terms of is regulatory impact causing an impact of regulatory change having an impact on the cost of capital. I do think you could look at corporate credit spreads and scratch your head a little bit in the sense that, spreads have been widening, pretty steadily for a little over a year now, during an environment that one would normally associate with credit spread tightening. So the economy is, getting better, et cetera. So I do think, if there is a liquidity impact, we know that a large portion of credit spread is considered a liquidity compensation anyway. The true default risk in corporate bonds is quite low, so that therefore the compensation for that risk should be quite low. So that does beg the question: well, then why then are spreads widening? And some of have asked whether that's not an indicator that maybe those liquidity pressures are having an actual impact.
Dennis, how concerned are you about the international competitiveness of U.S. markets? Do you think that's overrated as an issue?
We spend a fair amount of time. We've got people in Brussels and London and, nowhere near as much as the reach as others on the panel. And frankly, you see either two things happening, issuers and others coming to the U.S. markets, frankly, and other places in the globe trying to replicate the depth and breadth of the U.S. markets. So you have the Capital Markets Union initiative going on in Europe, which is a largely bank-centered financing across the continent. Right. And they look at the U.S. markets and see depth and breadth, and they're trying to replicate that. So not only are people not
fleeing from the U.S. A, they're coming to the U.S., and to the extent they're thinking about it elsewhere, including in Asia, actually, you even see it, but more, I think Europe's in the front of it with the Capital Markets Union Initiative. You see them trying to replicate our markets so that they can actually become competitive for some of these markets-based activities, which they don't have. So it's not only is it that there's no real competition elsewhere, but it's also just the depth and breadth and history of our markets, as Steve says.
Let me turn to the audience and ask them to ask some questions. And could I ask you to state who you are, and please make it fairly brief, and let's make it in the form of a question, hopefully not a speech. Let me start with you. Yes. There are mics, yes, thank you.
Michael Decker with SIFMA. There have been a number of experiments over the years with limit order type trading platforms for fixed income products, and they never really caught on. And focusing on a point that Mr. Riaz made about the buy side acting as price makers potentially, it seems like a lot of investors don't really want to use a system where they've got to post a position, an offering, and just let it hang out there for the market to see. They like the idea of being able to solicit executable quotes from dealers in a short period of time, knowing that they can trade at those prices immediately if they want to. Isn't that a factor in why these limit order type systems have never really caught on? It's really an issue of what investors need and want.
Anybody respond to that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's exactly right. I mean, there's been, you know, over the 20-something years I've been involved in the corporate bond market, I've lost track of how many initiatives there have been, electronic platforms designed, somewhat along the lines that you lay out. And the reality is the market has not needed that and does not seem to need that. There's kind of two reasons. One, you know, there's always this problem we have in the corporate bond market of too many CUSIPs and not enough opinions. I mean, there's lots and lots of securities and not enough people who care about the same ones at the same time. That's just kind of the nature of the market. I don't think it's a problem. That just is. So I think that's, you know, a little bit of it. It's a question of just that structural aspect. Secondly, it gets back to what are the purposes of ownership of these instruments. You know, who's to say that, you know, someone really cares, you know, a penny or two pennies, you know, away from the price, that they have, you know, tax considerations, long-term objectives for holding the securities, et cetera, liquidity premiums. I'm not so sure those bonds are supposed to trade. So I'm personally skeptical of the real opportunity for those types of platforms. I think history has borne that out.
Well, I think Annette and Rashid, you better say something, because sure. You are sort of telling us that these markets are out of date and they're not doing what they're supposed to do. So
no, I'd be happy
one
to.
Or so, both of you could respond to this question.
So one of the many topics we've highlighted under the heading of market structure modernization is specifically delves into the question of protocol. So traditionally, bond markets always use a request for protocol. Equity markets use the limit order. And in a way, those two protocols are appropriate for like two pools of liquidity. Request for quote is most appropriate for the most illiquid assets, and limit order books work well for quite liquid assets with good two-way flow. And there is a very finite set in the universe of corporate bonds that meet the criteria for really functional central limit order book trading. So there are a number of the newer, more recent attempts to jumpstart electronic trading involve different protocols, whether it's session-based trading where people are invited to trade in certain bonds at a certain time in order to concentrate the limited liquidity. And there's others like that. There's applications, for example, of dark pool-like technology in order to address one of the questions you asked about, that people don't want their order hanging out there. So I do think that there is a group of hybrid protocols that are suitable for different assets with different liquidity profiles, even within the broader corporate bond space.
Annette, did you want to add?
No, I agree very much with that. I agree that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, that the fixed income markets are very different from the equity markets, but that there are other opportunities to make use of technology and perhaps bring more participation into systems than we've heretofore achieved.
There's also, I mean, I think you'd recognize the barriers to entry to successful changes within the market are quite high and quite difficult. And I think you're going to see some real technology disruption over time and those barriers to entry coming down. And so when you look at kind of the incumbent system with the existing relationships and the existing practices where there's tremendous inertia, in addition to kind of incumbent protection going on, that it's a little bit misleading to look at those things that may not have worked in the past to say they're not going to work in the current and the future, because we also have a dramatic change with the growth of the asset managers and the buy-side interest and how these things are being done. And I think some of those interests are going to trump some of the other interests which have killed some of these ideas in the beginning. And I think you're going to see massive technology changes that make those what appear to be preferences today to be channeled requirements rather than actual preferences.
Okay. Questions? Yes, Lee Kuan.
Liakadam at Brookings Trustee. I'm struck that no one has said anything about credit default swaps, and it's always perplexed me. When credit default swaps were first introduced, the hope was that they would provide a sort of form of benchmark security in credit markets and do what futures and swaps did to the Treasury market and transform the liquidity of the market. So why did that not happen? Was it something about the design of the instrument? Was it something about the regulatory environment?
Who wants to pick up on that? We haven't talked about credit default
first
swaps.
I'm going to send it your way.
Fighting over not to answer.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good question. I mean, that absolutely
They have a bit of a mixed history, credit default swaps, although the ones on corporate bonds have not did not get into trouble, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the corporate bond CDS didn't get many people in trouble at all, yet it's borne the brunt of the regulatory impacts as it relates to derivatives, at least from a corporate bond market guy's perspective, I guess. I always find that somewhat interesting. But you're right. I mean, that was certainly was one of the premises. I guess what I would say is that, you know, simply looking at today's snapshot, why doesn't it work that way to maybe back into, you know, causes? You know, from our perspective, the reality is there just aren't enough participants that, you know, that care. So, you know, there's a lack of broad market participation. And I guess if I attribute that back, some of it certainly relates to, you know, the history, some relates to counterparty pressures, even though that we, you know, are slowly but surely, hopefully the SEC will get us all the way there eventually, you know, going to use central clearinghouses to clear all these trades, which should relieve counterparty concerns. I think there's still that, you know, that twitch is still in people's cerebral cortex. They, you know, they don't want to think about that, you know, that issue as compounding the risk in their books. You know, there's end users who simply don't want their investors to use those instruments. So there may be hesitancy on the part of asset managers to go through that education process with their end users. I'm not sure which effect is more dominant, but certainly those are factors. So in fact, some of the hedging instruments that the cautious firm of mine and others have talked about to try and develop better instruments to manage risk end up looking kind of like CDS, but in a cash market format. And I guess that does, you know, bring up one other reality is that, you know, CDS to CDS and cash bonds are cash bonds, and at the end of the day, they're never exactly the same thing. And, you know, the best hedge is always to get rid of the exact thing you're trying to get rid of, not something that's closely akin to it. But, you know, look, I think that, you know, there's been efforts underway to try and improve the liquidity of the CDS market. Again, some of that is an industry thing. I think that looks really structural about as the nature of the contract. And there's been a notion of reducing the number of coupon payments from 4 to 2 to try and bring a little bit even more homogeneity to that market, to tweak the composition of the indices a little bit to make them look more like the cash market. We view these things as positives. But I really do think that, you know, for me, getting all single names to clear would be a big positive, and we're still on a slow path there.
Did you want
to? Yeah, I do. I feel duty bound to, since I punted initially. So I think a couple of the reasons why one of them is just very important historical, that CDS grew in the run-up to the crisis and I think got caught up with all of their cousins. Yep. And became a bad word. I do think another important point is that and Steve alluded to this, is that when you look at who are the holders of credit and corporate bonds, the insurance assets, pension funds, retirement funds are a huge component. Most of those end investor types are not comfortable with derivatives positions. So they participate only in the cash market. The growth of CDS was helped in large part in the mid-2000s by a lot of investor types that have almost disappeared in the aftermath of the crisis. Leveraged credit hedge funds, arbitrage funds, and bank-owned proprietary trading groups. So those were the liquidity providers and most active participants in the single-name CDS market. As they largely didn't, make it to the present day, and you have a market that's more dominated by kind of long-only, quote, real money assets in the insurance, pension, and other space that tend not to be derivatives users, you've essentially had the single-name CDS market really dry up because of the lack of participants. In contrast, the index CDS market is the single most liquid credit product, as Steve pointed out earlier as well. So if a critical mass of single-name CDS were able to evolve and be cleared and come back, they would provide another kind of additional data point and pricing benchmark and help the price discovery process. So that's a hope, but I think that's some of the reason why they haven't been so active over the past several years.
One minor addendum I should note is that if there is an impact of leverage-based capital measurement on a credit business, certainly CDS is the product most impacted by that. So it's something to keep in mind. Again, that may be something that the system's fine with, given the history. I would argue maybe it's misguided history, but given what the specific instruments were that got folks in trouble. But that is a reality of our business. Leverage-based capital matters a lot, and CDS is not necessarily a friendly instrument under that regime.
But it would be interesting to see how the market would have developed, if it would have developed as intended, if it wasn't, to put it in a slightly different way, hijacked by the gamblers. And the problem is the market was hijacked by the gamblers. And so you had a product with an intention that had an expected kind of evolution that never happened, right? And it didn't happen in any size as expected. And so the question is whether or not that market in an appropriate way can be rehabilitated and reestablished, notwithstanding being hijacked by the gamblers and the blow-ups and the, all the other things that happened.
Well, would another possibility be that if that CDS market is not developed, or particularly is not developed for the certain classes of bonds, maybe does that show there isn't that much of a liquidity problem? Because if there were, we would see a more active CDS market. Does it show that there isn't as much of a problem as some people are concerned about? No, maybe not. Okay, let me turn back to the audience, Paul.
Paul Saltzman, Vice Chairman at Deutsche Bank. I was wondering if the panelists can talk about the connection between equity market volatility or equity market liquidity and liquidity issues in the corporate bond market. You know, is there a direct or indirect correlation there?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I think that there's definitely a correlation. I would point out, particularly for those who would argue that this will be viewed as being supportive of the current construct, which I'm hesitant to be labeled with. but I would note that during periods like the flash crash that we've seen in equities, a mini flash crash that we saw in the government bond market, the breaking of the Swissy peg in the FX market, which literally resulted in 100% losses for some hedge funds, whilst all that was going on, the corporate bond market continued doing its thing. Get a little quiet for 10 minutes or 20 minutes to kind of determine, is this a real thing that we should be concerned about, or is this just nonsense? It turned out in most cases it was kind of nonsense. And while people incurred significant losses with their machines that were turned on during those events, corporate bond market participants, suffered no losses. So there's something to having the human touch, I guess, still involved. But there is the risk of a feedback loop, both ways, and that's why, again, and not my base case, but in the scenario, the more of a stress scenario, we'll run for liquidity. If that manifests itself in corporate bond market weakness, it'll make its way back to the equity market for sure. It always has, and always will.
I agree with much of what you said, and I think it would be a mistake to think that all that occurs in the equity market is equally translatable into the fixed income markets. Obviously, there's been a lot of concern in the equity markets about the short-termism of certain traders in the equity markets, which as I said in my remarks, we actually don't have participating in the corporate bond markets. And so the concerns about liquidity are, again, that there are few, there may be fewer participants as dealers, and maybe there should be greater participation across the board, including more participation by the buy side. But the fact is that I think a lot of what we're seeing in the equity markets relates to a different structure that currently exists.
More questions? Yes?
Thank you, Peter Lindner, IMF. I have a question that's a little bit related to the last one, namely, what is the brave new world we are looking for, namely, what is liquidity? There was this definition brought up earlier that you can do trades without impacting the market, and there's often people use a slight variation of that definition, namely, you can do large trades in a short period of time without impacting the market. Now, by that definition, the U.S., the public U.S. equity market, is pretty illiquid. It's a great market to trade 500 or 1,000 shares of IBM, but if you want to trade a million, you go to the one of these dark pools, you get out of the limelight. That goes back to the issue that people don't want to post their big trades on a limit order book. Now, so where do we want to go to, and how desirable is it? Is it like it can, is it sensible to have a market where, you know, Joe Sixpack trades some bond on Greece or maybe on Hilton Hotels or something, and in 6 months it goes under and his bond gets taken away for zero because of some arcane provision in the prospectus? I don't know. But another side issue, maybe the, and that refers to some of the data that were brought out earlier, there's also isn't there a trend observable for one towards more indexed investing, which means less trading? And secondly, more, I believe some people say the share of smaller issues in the current maybe QE-induced issuance wave has increased relatively to larger issues. Traditionally, smaller issues have always traded less. So you would expect, you know, I think some people say 20 to 30% of quote unquote the reduction in trading over outstanding.
Okay, could you're be running on a little bit long here. Can we
so
get
anyway,
to the end of the question?
So these are my questions.
Okay.
1 minute or less.
Sure. Somebody want to respond to that?
I'll start with the first one. So the question was really, what is the desired level of liquidity? And I was the one in my remarks that made the point that said for this purpose we can define liquidity as the ability to trade, you know, X amount without material price move. So I think it goes without saying almost that when one is selling or buying a very large block of a security, that in the most well-functioning markets causes significant price moves. So I think the problem that's being referred to in the corporate bond market is that much smaller quantum, say a low to mid single-digit percent of an outstanding bond, trading that amount has become over time increasingly difficult without material price moves. And we've seen kind of evolution in trading behavior and tactics as a result, where investors might, say, fragment an order or a desired trade into smaller slices and pieces in order to have less of a market impact. So it's more about day-to-day kind of regular course of operations, buying and selling activity, rather than very significant moves. So I would say that's the desired level of activity. And I know I'm not putting a hard quantum on it, that it should be 5% of a bond or 3% of a bond. And I'm deliberately not doing so because, you know, one size doesn't fit all. There's very specific security level characteristics that matter. But anecdotally, it means being able to you know, trade modest amounts of an outstanding security without moving the price is the desired goal.
All right, I think there's a notion also, I think you bring up a good point, that you know, the equity market looks really liquid on the surface of it, and anybody who's traded institutional equities knows that it's not. Maybe that's not quite the case. So another alternative definition of liquidity might be, one is, you know, can I move my position relatively close to the price? Another definition of liquidity might be, can I move a really large position at a slight discount to the price? And I think that's that kind of speaks to this current environment and wraps back to the TRACE thing. I'm a huge believer and supporter in TRACE. TRACE has done great things for the marketplace in terms of transparency, and particularly around what it's done for small investors. That's a huge win, as has been outlined by several of my fellow panelists, and I would agree to 100%. That said, at the larger side of the trade distribution, the block trade size, for example, it is very difficult to move large blocks of securities when an outsized trade gets reported to the marketplace almost immediately. And I do think there's an opportunity there to improve liquidity at a price slightly away from the current market price, where liquidity premium is justified. But it would require, it would be helpful to have some what I'll call a tweak again in terms of how we report block trades. And most markets have some sort of rule around block trades, but the credit market does not.
We just about ran out of time. Do you have any last comments on that?
No, I agree with what was said.
Okay.
No, I mean, I agree. I think there's a problem looking, you know, there's not going to be a single definition of liquidity that applies at all times and all places or for market makers. And I think what you have to do, as alluded earlier, moving block trades and dealing with liquidity have been around since there's been trading and dealing with markets, period. And so there's nothing new and exciting and different today, except that with a larger context in terms of the Fed regulation, among other things, has happened. So I think instead of trying to look for kind of the magic solution or the one answer, I think, as has been alluded repeatedly, is it's a complex multi-factor analysis, and you have to drive into the facts of the market, the product, and the context at the time, and then try and deal with the facts then. And then you come up with a point that shows how you kind of deal with the particular problem at a particular time, given the context.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the audience to thank our panelists. And I'd like to thank them. That was terrific. And so we're now on to our next stage, and we're welcoming our keynote speakers. So we'll just take a minute to transfer over.
Good morning again, everyone. It is now my honor to present the two keynote speakers for today. The first is Antonio Weiss, counselor to Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. He will be followed by Governor Jay Powell of the Federal Reserve Board. After they each speak, we will gather back up here for me to have the chance to ask them a few questions, and then we'll give you and the audience a chance to ask your own questions. Both our speakers have had very distinguished careers combining the public and the private sectors. You can read the details in the bios that are provided out front, but I'm sure you'd rather hear them than hear me talk about them. So I'll leave it at that, except to say that it is a true honor to have them speak here today, and we are certainly grateful for their willingness to do so. So Antonio, let me give you the podium first.
Thank you, Doug. And let me also thank the previous panelists for talking about bond markets, but not Treasury bond markets. Jay and I are going to talk about Treasury bond markets, and my remarks are going to focus on market structure and the effects of technology. Now, as you may know, Treasury staff, working with the staff from the New York Fed, Federal Reserve Board, the SEC, the CFTC, recently released a report on volatility in the Treasury markets last October 15th. I would like to begin by acknowledging the teams at all five agencies for their hard work and close collaboration. The final report is the result of their rigorous analysis, and it really allows us for the first time to have a fact-based conversation about the events of that day and, importantly, the evolution of Treasury markets. Now, just to set the stage, as you all know, the Treasury market is the deepest and most liquid bond market in the world. There are over $12.5 trillion of marketable securities outstanding, and there are more than $500 billion of trades every day. Treasuries are the uncontested safe haven during periods of turbulence for investors all across the globe, and they're an essential element for primary and secondary market functioning, and for so many other things. October 15th remains an anomaly, but our analysis of that day underscores the profound changes taking place in the structure of the Treasury market, and in particular, the effects of technology. Today, I will provide a short description of what happened on October 15th and just remind everyone, probably no one here can forget it, and also discuss the factors that contributed to the volatility. I will then highlight some questions about market structure and suggest a preliminary framework for evaluating potential risks. Let's start with the events. As you all surely recall, that day was highly unusual. The 10-year yield experienced a 37 basis point swing, only to finish just 6 points lower, and there was a startling 16 basis point round trip during a 12-minute interval. There have been only three other days since 1998 when the 10-year has traded in such a wide range, and each resulted from an identifiable, significant monetary policy announcement. And there was nothing of the kind on or about October 15th. So as that day began at 8:30 in the morning, September retail sales were released, and they were modestly below expectations. And ordinarily, a miss of the magnitude, it was about 0.4%, would have driven yields down by maybe a couple of basis points. Instead, over the next hour, Treasury yields declined by 20 basis points. And then, at exactly 9:33 a.m., yields fell precipitously. Over the next 6 minutes, the 10-year yield dropped 16 basis points, only to retrace the entire move in the following 6 minutes. This 16 basis point round trip is what many have dubbed the flash rally, and what the report refers to as the event window. At that time, the head of one trading desk described conditions quite simply as panicked. In the days and weeks that followed, many explanations for what happened were put forward. Some suggested that an algorithm had misfired, or that a human trader had accidentally submitted an order to purchase a large number of treasuries. And others suggested, in fact, many others suggested, that algorithmic traders had simply shut off their machines. All of these suggestions, however, were speculative and, as it happens, inaccurate. At the time, no one, including official institutions, had examined detailed trade and order book data to test these hypotheses. The staff report, which I encourage all of you to read, if you can, represents the most comprehensive study of trading in the U.S. Treasury markets since a 1992 report following the Salomon Brothers bidding scandal and a regulatory report to Congress that followed in 1998. So what did we find? We find that a confluence of events laid the groundwork for the volatility of that day. As confidence in the economic recovery improved earlier in 2014, bets that U.S. interest rates would rise had become popular. In fact, by the end of September, leveraged short positions in near-term interest rate futures had reached record levels. And there's a chart in the report that really shows how dramatic that buildup was. But instead of increasing, interest rates marched steadily lower. In the first 2 weeks of October, growth and deflation risks in the Eurozone, accompanied by uncertainty at that stage about the ECB response, generated real doubt on the part of investors about the prospects for global growth. The pessimistic tone of the IMF World Bank meetings the weekend just prior to October 15th exacerbated sentiment. Investors and the public at large were also concerned, and this was really the moment this was happening, about the unprecedented outbreak of Ebola and its potential consequences. So in response to all of these risks, investors turned to treasuries, the safe haven, driving up prices and lowering yields. Levered funds, with record levels of short positions, were obviously caught on the wrong side of this trade, and they began to unwind the butts. And as they did so, that obviously further compressed yields. Now, all of this set the stage for the initial volatility on October 15th, that first 20 basis point move. But really none of it, and the report is clear about this, none of it explains the timing nor the distinctive pattern of Treasury yields during the 12-minute interval. In those 12 minutes, trading volumes exploded, and market depth, defined here as the amount available for purchase or sale in the order book, collapsed. Volumes in the futures market surged to 9 times typical levels, and market depth thinned by up to 80%. Now, much of this trading was conducted by firms that engage almost exclusively in algorithmic trading, labeled principal trading firms, or PTFs, in the report. In other words, instead of turning off their machines en masse, as some had guessed, PTFs not only stayed in the market, but they increased both their level and the proportion of overall volume. And in fact, during the round trip in prices, PTFs accounted for 70 to 75% of total trading in both cash and futures, up from about 50% on normal days. At the same time, bank dealers responded to the extreme volatility by widening their bid-ask spreads, and at times they withdrew altogether from the offer side of the order book, and this was especially true in the first 6 minutes of the rally. Both PTFs and bank dealers responded entirely rationally in an economic sense on October 15th. It made total sense for PTFs, who want to avoid accumulating large intraday positions, to reduce order size, and equally it made total sense for bank dealers to increase bid-ask spreads to compensate them for the positions they take in the midst of volatility. But the result of these rational individual decisions was a dramatic reduction in overall market depth. So while prices moved at an extraordinary speed over those 12 minutes, price action remained continuous, and this was an important finding. Trading occurred all the way down in yield and then all the way back up. There were absolutely no gaps. Indeed, many PTFs with whom Treasury spoke, unlike traditional banker dealers, noted that in their view, the market continued to function well throughout the day. It was not broken like the equity markets during the May 6, 2010 flash crash. So in addition to debunking the notion that PTFs turned off their machines, the analysis did not find any evidence of a fat finger mistake, i.e. an accidental large order, or a runaway algorithm. There was also no cascade of stop-loss orders, as is often the case with mini flash crashes in other markets. So what did happen and what was the cause? Well, from what we know, there was really no direct causal link between any one player and the activity we saw on October 15th. But a large part of the story of what happened between 9:33 and 9:45 a.m. appears to turn to us on the interaction at very high speeds of complex algorithms that generate massive amounts of trading activity at speeds far too fast for human beings to track. High-speed trading algorithms, which are employed by many bank dealers and by hedge funds, as well as by PTFs, appear to respond to an extraordinarily one-sided trading environment with far more willing buyers than sellers by generating a rapid rally in treasuries. And human traders took a few minutes to react. So one active market participant we spoke with contrasted this dynamic to trading in Boeing stock in mid-July of 2013. And what happened in mid-July of 2013 is that Boeing dropped suddenly by 7% because there was an unoccupied Dreamliner that caught fire at Heathrow. So in contrast, this market participant said, look, on October 15th, I needed to spend 5 minutes or so scanning news headlines checking Twitter feeds, making a few phone calls, and only then was I able to confirm that there was no identifiable event. There was no fire in this case, and he was willing to step in. So the conclusions of the October 15th report were unsatisfying to some because we didn't uncover a single smoking gun. But as is often the case in complex systems, and certainly the Treasury markets are one complex system, it is difficult to reduce outcomes to simple causes. Moreover, the broader findings of the report were equally, if not more, significant. The evolution of Treasury markets, in particular cash markets, represents a fundamental technology-driven shift in market structure. Now, we have all been aware of this shift for some time, but the report has cast a brighter light on it and has given us the facts and figures to be able to see the extent of the shift. Algorithmic trading, as was discussed in the previous panel, was well established in equities and futures, and it's been that way since the late 1990s. It now accounts for a majority of trading in the most standardized liquid securities, including more than half of activity on interdealer platforms in cash treasury markets. High-frequency trading, which is a subset of algorithmic trading, is applied in a number of strategies by a whole array of firms, ranging from owner-operated startups to large hedge funds and, indeed, bank dealers. It is quite simply a disruptive technology innovation, and it has reshaped the entire industry structure. It's exerted competitive pressure on traditional players by tightening pricing parameters, and it's created obvious informational advantages. As with any major technology disruption, there are risks and benefits. Now, the key for policymakers is to recognize that this technology is here to stay, and we need to be forward-thinking about its effects on market functioning. At Treasury, we're engaged with market participants, academics, policymakers to better understand this new market structure. And our view is that any policy proposals should be carefully tailored to address specific risks they're designed to address. So today I'll just share a few thoughts on four broad categories of risk that will help to guide our future inquiry: operational, oversight, fair dealing, and market resiliency. First, operational risk. Now, operational risk is, of course, inherent in any financial transaction. But the extraordinary speed and the automated nature of execution mean that this risk may be heightened in the case of high-frequency trading and the race for ever-faster technology. The constant pursuit to save one more millisecond not only consumes resources potentially better deployed elsewhere, but it increases the pressure, as someone said in the last panel, on the plumbing of the system to handle ever-increasing speeds and message traffic. So we need to consider whether the race for speed at this already very advanced stage is helping or hurting market functioning. A second related category is oversight and risk management. Many of the large new entrants in Treasury markets are not subject to regular oversight and may not be sufficiently capitalized to withstand unexpected losses. Now, we all remember 2012 and the collapse of night trading, which had about 17% of equity markets. Now, that was a case where untested software wrought havoc in markets, and it put one of the largest trading firms out of business in a matter of hours. We need to assess how minimum standards are set for testing new systems and for introducing new algorithms. And there's the question equally of margin requirements, which in some cases may only be assessed a couple of times per day, sometimes more frequently. But they're not set at the speed of high-frequency trading, which sees trades executed in a fraction of a second. The third category might broadly be described as fair dealing. Now, while trading practices that are manipulative or fraudulent are not new to financial markets, automated trading may provide traders with additional tools to beat the system. The report discusses self-trading, which is simply where one legal entity is on both sides of a trade. Now, during the flash rally, the amount of self-trading was elevated, and this was especially so in the first half of the event window. Now, not all self-trading is illegal, and I want to be absolutely clear that I'm making no assumptions regarding the legality of the activity on that or any other day. But we do need to learn much more about the reasons for self-trading, and we have to consider whether there are benefits that outweigh the potential appearance of impropriety. Now, the Treasury Markets Practice Group, working with the New York Fed, adopted a revised set of best practices encouraging firms, quite simply, to submit bona fide offers and to avoid manipulative practices, such as submitting a barrage of orders to increase latency, in effect, intentionally clogging the system, or submitting orders with the intent to cancel them before execution. Both practices are an important, best practices are an important complement to regulatory oversight, but they are not universally adopted. Moreover, many participants, as I mentioned, in the Treasury market are not even required to register with regulatory authorities. So additional work is required to determine best practices and to identify and close regulatory gaps. The fourth category, and the broadest, is quite simply market resiliency. Perhaps the key question asked by the report is whether an improvement in average liquidity by certain metrics, not all, but an improvement, whether that improvement may have come at the cost of rare but severe bouts of volatility. Now, numerous factors are changing the way our markets function and the way liquidity is provided. The persistence of low bid-ask spreads on October 15th, together with record volumes and a severe deterioration in market depth, may be an indication that we need to rethink and modernize how we think about liquidity and the metrics we apply. Underlying all of these issues, all of these questions, is the essential role of access to data and coordination across markets and agencies. The only readily available data are futures market transaction reports provided to the CFTC. Order book data are available on request by the CFTC. Information about activity in cash treasury markets is not readily accessible, and authorities have virtually no visibility on dealer-to-customer activity, which by some estimates is over 40% of the market. Moreover, regulatory authority over treasury cash and futures markets is highly fragmented, making cooperation essential, and the report was an example of effective cooperation, but also slowing response times considerably. Put simply, we cannot get the information we need to analyze risk across treasury markets in anything that approaches real time, and that has to change. So in concluding, the report on October 15th and the work to follow, including today's discussion, represent an opportunity to undertake the most comprehensive review of the treasury market since 1998, many years before algorithmic trading even began in treasuries. Now, it's not clear what the end state for treasury markets will be, and in this period of transition, policymakers and market participants have an opportunity to shape events, and we should learn from our experience in other markets as we do so. As we undertake this important work, we will be deliberate in our analysis, diligent in gathering the best ideas, and fact-based in our policy prescriptions. And policy should ideally be tailored to the specific risks we identify. But it's clear that the Treasury market is constantly evolving And we need not only to keep pace with events, but also to plan and to plan wisely for the future. Thank you.
Let me too thank Doug and Martin for putting this together. It's great to be here today. I also enjoyed this morning's panel, earlier panel, and had the unusual experience of nodding my head affirmatively and listening to all four of the panelists. So, my involvement with these markets, Treasury markets, goes back to the early 1990s when I served as Undersecretary for Finance. Some of you will recall the Solomon Brothers bidding scandal that broke in the summer of 1991. And that event required those of us with oversight responsibilities to do a thorough evaluation of the structure of the primary Treasury market, the auction market, and ultimately to propose a series of reforms which made their way into an interagency report that Antonio mentioned a little earlier, which we published in 1992. As part of that process, we also put together a public conference to consider further reforms to Treasury auction procedures with participation from regulators, academics, and the financial sector. And some of the ideas that came out of that conference eventually led to changes in the way that primary auctions were conducted, changes that I believe were beneficial to the integrity of the Treasury market. I'm thinking there particularly of the single price auction. Of course, the issues we're talking about today relate to the secondary market rather than to auctions. And although the Treasury market remains deep and resilient, there are nonetheless reasonable questions as to whether market functioning can be improved. The events of October 15th have been folded into a more general debate about market liquidity across markets. And I'll say that I take the concerns about a decline in market liquidity seriously. That said, it's hard evidence on the level of liquidity in secondary Treasury markets is mixed. There are some measures that are at or above pre-crisis levels, and some suggest a reduced ability to trade large positions without material price impact, which I would say is a reasonable definition of liquidity. And it's also possible that liquidity may be more prone to disappearing at times of stress. On October 15th, for example, market depth declined sharply, and we saw a sudden spike in prices that was without precedent for a period with little relevant news. Other events, like the 2013 taper tantrum, the bund tantrum of last spring, and the sharp moves on March 18th in the euro-dollar exchange rate, all broadly show the same pattern, rapidly diminishing liquidity and large price moves for a given quantum of news. But the causes and implications of these events are unclear. Is this the new normal? It's important to simply say that we don't know. Current macroeconomic and market conditions are unprecedented in many respects. For now, what we have is a small number of broadly similar events that bear careful consideration. Most of these considerations apply across markets, but they're particularly important here in the Treasury market because of the crucial role Treasury securities play in the global financial system. As Antonio covered, in addition to serving the financing needs of the U.S. government, Treasury markets are important for the conduct of monetary policy. They serve as high-quality liquid assets for a wide range of financial institutions, including dealers in the Treasury market, and as collateral in countless transactions. Treasury securities are a global reserve asset, and Treasury markets are a key vehicle through which market participants manage their interest rate risk. The integrity and continued liquidity of the Treasury market affect nearly everyone. Treasury markets have undergone important changes over the years. The footprints of the major dealers who have long played the role of market makers are in several respects smaller than they were pre-crisis, and dealers cite a number of reasons for that change, including reductions in their own risk appetite and the effect of post-crisis regulations. At the same time, the Federal Reserve and foreign owners, about half of which are foreign central banks, have increased their ownership to over two-thirds of outstanding treasuries, up from 61% in 2004. Banks have also increased their holdings of treasuries to meet HQLA requirements. These holdings are less likely to turn over in the secondary market as the owners largely follow buy and hold strategies. But another change is the increased presence of asset managers, which now hold a bigger share of treasuries as well. mutual fund investors in particular now beneficially own a larger share of treasuries, and they are accustomed to daily liquidity. Perhaps the most fundamental change in these markets is the move to electronic trading, which began in earnest about 15 years ago. And it is hard to overstate the transformation in these markets. Only two decades ago, the dealers who participated in primary treasury auctions, primary dealers, had to send personal representatives to the offices of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York to submit their bids on auction days. They dropped their paper bids into a box. The secondary market was a bit more advanced. There were electronic systems for posting interdealer quotes in the cash market, and the Globex platform had been introduced for futures. Still, most interdealer trades were conducted over the phone, and futures trading was conducted in the pit. Today, of course, these markets are almost fully electronic. Interdealer trading in the cash treasury market is conducted over the electronic trading platforms. And thanks to advances in telecommunications and computing, the speed of trading has increased at least 1 million-fold. Advances in computing and faster access to trading platforms have also allowed new types of firms and trading strategies to enter the market. Algorithmic and high-frequency trading firms deploy a wide and diverse range of strategies. In particular, the technologies and strategies that people associate with high-frequency trading are also regularly employed by broker-dealers, by hedge funds, and even by individual investors. Compared with the speed of trading 20 years ago, anyone can trade at high frequencies today. And so to me, this transformation is really more about technology than it's about any one particular type of firm. Given all these changes, we need to have a more nuanced discussion as to the state of the markets. And I would start by asking, are there important market failures that are not likely to self-correct? And if so, what are the causes, and what are the costs and benefits of market-led or regulatory responses? Some observers point to post-crisis regulation as a key factor that's driving any decline or change in the nature of liquidity. Although regulation had little to do, if anything, with the events of October 15th, I would agree that it may be one factor driving recent changes in market making. Requiring banks to hold much higher levels of capital and liquidity and to rely less on wholesale short-term debt has raised funding costs. Regulation has also raised the cost of funding inventories through the repo markets. Thus, regulation may have made market making less attractive to banks. But these same regulations have also materially lowered banks' probabilities of default and the chances that another financial crisis, like the last one, which severely constrained liquidity and did so much damage to our economy, will take place. These regulations are new, and we should be willing to learn from experience, but their basic goals, to make the core of the financial system safer and to reduce systemic risk, are appropriate and necessary. And we should be prepared to accept some increase in the cost of market making in order to meet those goals. And regulation is only one of the factors, and clearly not the dominant one, behind the evolution in market making. As we've seen, markets were undergoing dramatic change long before the financial crisis. Technological change has allowed new types of trading firms to act as market makers for a large and growing share of transactions, not just in equity and foreign exchange, but also in treasury markets. As traditional dealers have lost market share, one way they've sought to remain competitive is by attempting to internalize their customer trades, essentially trying to create their own markets by finding matches between their customers who are seeking to buy and sell. Internalization allows these firms to capture more of the bid-ask spread, but it also may reduce liquidity in the public market. At the same time, it does not eliminate the need for a public market, where price discovery mainly occurs, as dealers have to place the orders they can't internalize into that market. So while the changes I've discussed are unlikely to simply go away, I believe that markets will adapt to them over time. In the meantime, we've got a responsibility to make sure that market and regulatory incentives appropriately encourage an evolution that will sustain market liquidity and functioning. In thinking about market incentives, one observer has noted that trading rules and structures have grown to matter critically as trading speeds have increased. In her words, and I'm quoting here, "At very fast speeds, only the market microstructure matters." Trading algorithms are simply a set of rules, after all, and they will necessarily interact with and optimize against the rules of trading platforms they operate on. If trading at nanoseconds, which are billionths of seconds, is taking place, there won't be a lot of fundamental news to trade on or much time to formulate views about the long-run value of an asset. Instead, trading at these speeds can become a game played against order books and the market rules. We can complain about certain trading practices in this environment, but if the market is structured to incentivize these practices, then we ought not be surprised when they occur. So the trading platforms in both the interdealer cash and futures markets are based on a central limit order book in which quotes are executed based on price and the order they're posted. A central limit order book provides for continuous trading, but it also provides incentives to the fastest. A trader that is faster than the others in the market will be able to post and remove orders in reaction to changes in the order book before others can do so, earning profits by hitting out-of-date quotes and avoiding losses by making sure that the trader's own quotes are up to date. Technology and greater competition have led to lower costs in many areas of our economy, including the financial markets. At the same time, slower traders may be put at a disadvantage in this environment, which could cause them to withdraw from markets or seek other venues, thus fracturing liquidity. And one can certainly question how socially useful it is to build fiber optic or microwave networks just to trade at millionths or billionths of a second rather than thousandths of a second. The cost of these technologies, among other factors, may also be driving greater concentration in markets, which could threaten their resilience. And the type of internalization now done by dealers is really only profitable at large scale, and that too may have led to greater concentration. So a number of observers have suggested reforms for consideration. And let me be clear, I'm not recommending any of these, but merely noting the conversation that's going on and encouraging more. For example, some recent commentators propose frequent batch auctions as an alternative to the central limit order book and argue that this would lead to greater market liquidity. Others have argued that the current market structure may lead to greater volatility and suggested possible alterations designed to improve that situation. Questions about market structure also arise in funding markets for treasuries. As many have noted, there is a close link between funding liquidity and market liquidity. And for treasury markets, the links to funding in the repo market are especially close. Post-crisis reforms have made the repo market safer, but also raised the cost of repo transactions. Greater use of central clearing could potentially lower these costs by allowing participants to net more of their transactions. And authorities have emphasized a greater use of clearing for a wide range of products, and I believe there could be benefits from central clearing of repo markets as well. There are several private proposals out there looking at that and trying to accomplish it, and any solution will have to satisfy some fairly demanding regulatory requirements. To wrap up, we need more clarity on the implications of structural changes in these critical markets for market liquidity and market functioning. This is a good time to hold another public conference to discuss Treasury market structure, in fact, and that is one of the recommendations in the October 15th report released last month. The conference will take place this fall. In fact, I'm just informed this morning that we've settled on dates October 20 and 21 at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in cooperation with the Treasury Department, the Board of Governors, the SEC, and the CFTC. My hope and expectation is that the conference will bring market participants and regulators closer to an understanding of whether there are changes in trading and risk management practices, regulation, and market structure that could make our Treasury markets even more liquid and more resilient. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. And thank you both. I thought those were very interesting remarks on a very complex subject. Let me ask each of you a few questions before we go to the audience. So I'll do it in the same order as you spoke. Let me second your suggestion that the audience should read the interagency report if you haven't. It's a little dry, admittedly, but there's a lot of very good information.
There are pictures in the back.
There are pictures in the back. By the way, one of my recommendations would be to have them throughout the document. It would have been a lot more fun to read.
We discussed that.
But anyway, it is a very useful report because, as has been pointed out, we've lacked a lot of information about how the market works these days. But one thing you yourself noted, Antonio, was that it wasn't possible for you in a data-driven analysis to talk about the dealer interactions with their own customers, which is as much as 40% of the market. And I can respect your desire to only talk about what came from the data, but you must have also had discussions with the banks and the other dealers as to what their interactions were in general with their customers during that time period. Is there any color you can give us about what was going on at that level?
Well, I mean, as you say, Doug, we weren't able to get anywhere near the level of data
right.
that could be, you know, BrokerTec and eSpeed were able to provide us with everything we needed to get to the same level in analysis and cash as in futures. And, you know, we have nothing other than anecdotal sort of evidence for the rest of it. We don't actually even know that it's 40% of the market broker to customer. So that's just pure estimate. Could be higher, could be somewhat lower. Maybe people here have different views on that. You know, we do know because we were calling around all day, and we generally were speaking with bank dealers, right. not algorithms.
Right.
And those bank dealers said, look, this is the most stressed the environment has been since the financial crisis. And they did say that these were panicked conditions. And we do have that evidence, which I mentioned, about a withdrawal on the offer side during the first 6 minutes of the spike. So it's possible there was a more severe withdrawal on that part. I should mention there were some anecdotes that we were completely unable to verify, and they may be apocryphal, that there were volumes that came from that market onto the interdealer market during the spike. And so I really would just circle back to what I said at the end, which is that we have to rethink, you know, how officials receive data in all of these markets and the timeliness of the receipt of that data.
Okay. Now, something that I found very interesting in the report was when you looked at principal trading firms, there were critical periods, in fact, I think probably both on the up and on the down, when one set of principal trading firms was effectively a provider of liquidity and another set was essentially a consumer of liquidity as they took positions. If I can oversimplify, it sounds somewhat like there's a set of PTFs that are effectively taking market-making roles and another set that are probably by and large momentum players that tend to be following the trends. I was wondering, did you get any sense of whether there were clear groupings of which of these firms were in which category, or am I being way oversimplified? Or?
I mean, it's hard to talk about this without simplifying to some extent.
Yeah.
But firms had both, you know, passive and aggressive strategies, and so. You know, the passive or the resting orders on both sides of the order book. You know, were predominantly from PTFs, and the aggressive orders were also predominantly from PTFs. So really throughout the spike, that 70 to 75% that we identified, you know, PTFs were on both the passive and the aggressive side of things.
I guess what I was guessing, I'm just wondering if you have any sense of it, is that while there was some overlap, there were a set of PTFs that were mostly passive and a set that were mostly aggressive. Were you able to group them at all?
I mean, we do have more. We have aggregated the information we have, you know, to preserve the data that we received. But, I mean, I think what we can say is that it's just not possible to categorize individual firms on that basis. I mean, there are firms which describe themselves as primarily providing arresting orders. There are other firms that describe themselves as doing both. You know, it was very much of a mixed picture that day.
Okay, and if I can step back and kind of on behalf of the audience ask you a big picture question, and I think we'll bring it to Jay as well. It seems like there are two possible big picture theories here. One says, who the hell cares what happens in a 12-minute period if at the end of the day you're done with it? Does this mean anything? And then there's another way of looking at it, which says, if things can go that wrong for a 12-minute period, who knows what might be sparked in the future, and maybe this is tip of the iceberg and there are deeper problems. What are your reactions to those theories? You think, as usual, the truth is kind of somewhere in between? Or?
I mean, I think that the truth is that, you know, this was a really, you know, an awakening for market participants. You know, it was something like 6 standard deviations from what anybody had seen. And so, no, we need to take it very seriously for all the reasons Jay described. I mean, treasuries, we fund the government with treasuries. Treasuries are a benchmark for pretty much every financing transaction. They're an integral part of pretty much every trade, high-quality liquid asset. And so, no, we need to be vigilant about events like that. It did, of course, self-correct, but because it self-corrected the one time, you can't count on it self-correcting in some future date. And so we feel we have a lot of work to do to understand it. We remain confident in the markets. I mean, the markets are the most liquid in the world and with the fewest anomalous events of this sort. But they're the most important market. They're our market.
So you think people should continue to buy treasuries? Is that your...
You said it, Doug.
Exactly. Yeah. Jay, I know that was a rather amorphous question, but do you have any... Give it your own views how much this matters?
So I think it's important to take a step back and put it in context. So technology is evolving. Firm risk appetite and risk management is evolving. The supply and demand of liquidity is evolving, and regulation is evolving, and they're all evolving at the same time. Markets are adapting to that at the same time. So you have to look at these events and, you know, ask whether they matter or not, which is kind of the sense of your question. Does it matter that for 12 minutes things did things that we couldn't really explain? So if it only happens once, maybe it doesn't matter so much. But the real question is there a pattern? And I just don't think we know. I think it's frustrating, but we don't really know. I think, you know, rates will be increasing over time. Presumably volatility, as we get away from the zero lower bound, volatility will return to more normal levels just as an arithmetic matter. It'll be able to do that. And I think we'll be learning. And I think that's what we have to do is learn as this process goes on.
Okay. And... question for you, Jay, and Antonio, you may want to chime in as well. I was very struck by, Jay, your explicit characterization and Antonio's implicit characterization that to some extent what happened was the first reactions were from algorithmic trading systems that, by definition, pretty much act on so-called technical information. And just to be clear, that this is a term of art, meaning something that's based purely on price action and volume and things like that, rather than an attempt to determine more fundamentally, is the U.S. a better borrower at this point in time or a worse borrower, or will there be changes in the way the markets operate or whatever, mostly like things like economic news. There may be some algorithmic trades that try to trade on fundamentals, but given how fast they trade, they can't really be doing very much of that because, as you pointed out, Jay, there's not a lot of new fundamental information each millisecond. Do you think First of all, do you think that's a reasonable characterization? I presume you do, since I think I'm partly paraphrasing you. But to the extent that's true, is it a problem if we have a market increasingly dominated, at least in the short run, by technical analysis rather than an attempt to analyze underlying value?
So what I actually said in my remarks was that at very, very high speeds, for some traders, it can evolve into a game that's played against, you know, the order book and the market rules. It can, for some traders, become that. That doesn't mean, I think one of the takeaways from this excellent report, and I think, if I may say so, and from the reading that I've done, is that there are just many, many different strategies out there. I don't think it's very hard to generalize about what algorithmic and high-frequency traders are doing. Certainly, they are doing things which are all about price discovery. Some of them are doing things that are all about market making. You know, in fact, they're taking share from the more traditional market makers, who, by the way, are also operating with algorithms. It's one of those areas where I think you have to really be very careful in drawing your conclusions. I really didn't mean to be putting much of a value judgment in that part of my remarks.
No, and I'm sorry if I implied you were. I've designed technical trading systems for foreign exchange years ago, so this is something I've thought a lot about. There is a legitimate argument that while technical trading may kind of help smooth out markets, has some advantages, I personally would be a little worried if most of the trading out there ended up being on purely technical basis, not an attempt to see what the true underlying value was. So I was just curious if you had an opinion, but I don't want to press you on that. Any comments you might want to add?
I agree with Jay's comments. There's been a large buildup in fundamental investing, and through the last 10 or 15 years, and record fixed income issuance, and much of that is in the hands of sovereign funds, long-dated liability managers, mutual funds invest on a fundamental basis, and so forth. So these are not mutually exclusive. Perhaps I could come back to also what you said earlier about does it matter about the jump and so forth. I think what we need to be particularly focused on is prices that overshoot and don't self-correct, or price movements that create a lack of confidence in markets. And, that's what makes the work so urgent. I mean, if a price overshoots and doesn't autocorrect, and if that's in one of our major markets, then it's going to affect the cost of financing for some period of time in the real economy, and it's going to affect confidence in markets. So, much as this is a complex system, it's really on us to try to think through it, to think ahead, and, starting with treasuries seems to us foundational for further work.
Okay, and then one more question before I turn it to the audience. I'll start with you, Jay, but Antonio, you can add thoughts if you want. Clearly, part of what this groundbreaking study has demonstrated is a very significant shift in market making away from banks and their affiliates and other traditional broker-dealers towards these principal trading firms as playing quite a similar role, effectively providing market making. What are the pros and cons of that shift?
So I think it's an empirical question, actually. It may be, I don't think you have an answer from sort of theory here. I think if algorithmic trading proves to be good at market making, that's fine. Of course, the question is whether the incentives and the nature and character of that liquidity are different, because there's no balance sheet there with high frequency traders, whereas with the old traders there was. And it still is a balance sheet. There's a balance sheet. Now, admittedly, I would say, and the report says that they were sort of short and medium term liquidity providers, whereas the HFTs are really short term, just short term, as in very short term, before you can't even blink your eyes that fast in many cases. So is it better or worse? I don't know. There may be room for both approaches. I think, as Antonio indicated, our job is to look ahead and ask, will this serve the public? Liquidity is a public good, just like safe and sound large financial institutions are a public good. The safety and soundness of them is, let's say. I think it's an empirical question.
Antonio, any thoughts on the benefits and the costs of that shift?
Well, first, I mean, high-frequency trading is an activity, and it's an activity that's carried out by the PTFs we discuss, but also by some number of hedge funds and some number of bank dealers. I think what's interesting about the ones who predominantly trade high-frequency is that, you know, they just operate on their own capital for the most part. The capital isn't much. They're relatively recent. We know far less about them than we know about the bank dealers and even the hedge funds. And, you know, I think I mentioned that there are these four areas of risk. I'm sure one could come up with more or categorize them differently. And, you know, but I think as we do this work, just as with anything, first, as I tried to mention, you know, we don't need blunt instruments that act in a broad way, you know, and don't address specific risks that concern us. And I think that the second point behind this that I should mention is that you don't make mass changes to complex systems rapidly. One of the aspects of this is that there's an opportunity for piloting. So Jay mentioned, for example, small batch auctions, and you know, it is possible to pilot different policy ideas around high frequency trading and to get some initial results from it. But if something constitutes, you know, 50% plus of all standardized, you know, securities, or it's headed to that, you know, you don't make radical changes in an instant.
Fair enough. All right. Let's give the audience a chance. And again, as Martin was pointing out as well, please make sure you ask an actual question, if you could. And if you need a little prologue to that, please try to keep it relatively short. Please identify yourself and your institution if you're associated with an institution. Okay.
Sir?
The first question is to Governor Powell. Your former colleague, Governor Jeremy Stein, has advocated for a tough love on the part of the monetary authorities. In plain English, he doesn't really believe that the Federal Reserve Bank and other central banks should incorporate what Councillor Weiss called panic conditions. I suppose my question to you, sir, is what is your stance on the proper parenting on the part of the monetary authorities? And assuming that you were for the Federal Reserve to incorporate financial conditions, what are the implications for the policy framework of the Fed?
Sir, were you, just to make sure I understood you, you were asking about whether financial stability concerns should be incorporated into the making of monetary policy?
To some extent. In fact, if I were to go back to the presentation of Mr. Weiss, when we have a five sigma move in asset prices, which turn out to be noise, should the Fed be concerned about the noise in the market, and what are the implications for policy prescriptions?
So this could be another whole conference. And it's
excellent,
really
not idea. Come on back.
No, the subject of how to think about financial stability in the context of monetary policy generally is too deep and broad to even attempt to answer in this context. I will, though, give you this. As monetary policy is normalized, it's reasonable to expect increases in volatility. If you look back at some of the events I talked about, the taper tantrum, the Bund tantrum, you don't really see much of a mark on the real economy. October 15th certainly was so quick it wouldn't have left a mark, but in fact, they don't seem to have had much effect on the real economy, and from that standpoint, wouldn't really play much of a role in the broader question.
Other questions?
Yep. Liaquat Ahmed, Brookings Trustee. I want to ask a very broad question. Post-2008, there was this perception, in part because of testimony in front of Congress, that there was a fundamental conflict of interest between market makers and their clients. And, you know, whether that was correct or not, that was the perception in the public. Then you get Michael Lewis's new book, Flash Boys. And I'm struck how what a major bestseller it was. And the fundamental takeaway from that was that, you know, high-frequency trading is sort of a form of institutionalized front-running, and that all the markets are stacked against, you know, people, against individuals and final investors. How worried are you about this sort of growing sense of cynicism about the way major financial markets work?
I'll take a swing. So as Antonio indicated earlier, confidence in financial markets is absolutely critical. The loss of confidence was central to the financial crisis. So people have to believe, and it has to be true, that the markets are honest and that people get a reasonable deal when they transact in the financial market. So nothing could be more fundamental in financial regulation and finance generally than confidence. I have to say the story is way more complicated than the Flash Boys story. You know, it's not just about sniping slowly moving traders at all. There's a lot going on. To take another swing at Doug's earlier question, the benefits of all this technology are more efficiency and narrower bid-ask spreads and things like that. So you get benefits from technology, as Antonio indicated. We need to be thinking ahead about how it's not going away, right? So we need to be thinking ahead about how technology can help. We can use technology to our benefits. And there are many, many different strategies going on out there. I think, you know, just to echo your point, it's unfortunate when bad things happen that damage confidence, and we have to look out for those.
I would only add to that, you know, intermediaries are businesses. You know, investors generally are either investing for profit or investing on behalf of others for profit. And we want them to be businesses. And high-frequency trading firms are businesses. I think the question is, you know, is our knowledge and understanding of high-frequency trading firms as a whole at the same level as our understanding of the other categories? And the answer is no. At the same time, you know, we should not paint with a broad brush. I mean, I think there are a variety of firms. There are a variety of practices. There's a variety of practice around some of the risks that I identified. The way an algorithm is introduced, for example, varies, you know, quite significantly from one firm to another. The way we preserve confidence is talking openly about these issues and not ignoring them. But it's not simple. And one should expect, you know, Jay mentioned the 1992 report, and some of the regulatory oversight was done much later. But this will take time, and it should take time.
Okay. Martin?
This is a question about the impact of possible events in the real economy on financial markets and the current structure of financial markets. There's still some uncertainty about the Fed and when it's going to raise rates and how quickly, so that's sort of hanging over the market a little bit. And then the budget negotiations look awfully tough. The bills that are being reported out, I think, mostly are going to be vetoed by the president. So we may have a shutdown. We may have a very difficult budget period coming up. Do you think that the markets as we've described them, with mostly trading through algorithms, are they sort of in shape that they're going to be able to deal with this uncertainty, or is there concern that the changing structure of markets makes it harder to deal with that kind of uncertainty?
That's a complex question. I will say that I mentioned that there were three intraday moves that were larger than 37 basis points, and one of those was on the day that the United States was downgraded. And, you know, one hopes that Congress will do the right thing, and as we approach this next debt limit, because it does have the capacity to spook markets and to spook, you know, the beyond just treasuries. You know, this has been in place as a structure for several years. We've seen how it works, but it's precisely as we enter a period of more normalized interest rates and there is greater volatility, you know, that we need to anticipate greater volatility and that we need to be thinking deeply about market structures. You know, part of the whole pitch and fever around this discussion of liquidity, and this is Jay's area and his colleagues, you know, has also to do with the very simple reality that we're exiting, what is it, 7 years at the lower bound. And that does create, you know, a general anxiousness. And, you know, the way one has to think about it is that not all volatility is illiquidity. Some of it is price discovery. Now, price discovery today with more electronic trading for the standardized products is done differently than it was 10 or 15 years ago. It's done in smaller trades that are sequenced. But we don't know that produces a worse result or a better result than the old method of price discovery. I mean, a large trade that you issue to your bank dealer, you know, under the old system, you knew the price and you knew the total amount of the trade. And the new system, at least in some of the standardized securities, electronic, you know, that'll be unbundled into a bunch of trades. That doesn't necessarily mean that the investor is getting a worse deal. So we're in this new environment. The fall or the next year or whenever it comes will induce more volatility, but we all need to be disciplined about distinguishing between volatility and illiquidity, because it always follows.
So I guess I would just add, markets are very difficult to predict in the short and medium term, and they will do things and overreact sometime and apparently underreact others, but not every market reaction has important implications for the real economy. So if you think about 2013, we had the fiscal cliff, we had the government shutdown. In the middle of that, we had the taper tantrum. And I challenge anyone to look back, take, for example, look at monthly payrolls for 2013, or GDP for that matter, and show me where the taper tantrum was. Show me where the, you know, where the government shutdown was. They didn't leave much of a mark, which isn't, so it isn't to say that markets won't react as interest rates rise. They very well may, but it's not clear that there will or won't be much of a reaction in the real economy.
Okay. I think there's somebody in the back. Sorry. I guess I don't see so bad. Alice, were you?
Alice Rivlin Brookings. Let me turn Martin's question around, because he essentially said if the Congress does something, Congress and the President really do something terribly stupid, will there be volatility in the markets? My question is, maybe there should be, how much volatility in the markets would it take to get the attention of Congress and the President that maybe they're doing something really dumb? Back in 87, the stock market drop was widely thought to have precipitated concern with the budget deficit. There probably was no connection between the two, but it was nice to have something bad that happened in the markets that got attention.
That was a wonderful rhetorical question that contained its own answer. No, we're not wishing for a bad event in markets. We're wishing for, and we're not predicting markets, and we're not predicting how the fall will unfold. But I guess I would just say what I said earlier, which is that, you know, we expect, with respect to the debt limit, that Congress will do the right thing, and that it will not become complicated and hostage politically to other elements. So As to how the markets anticipate that, as to whether that creates volatility or not, in the past it has, at times it hasn't. And I think as you said and as Jay said, at times volatility emerges for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with political or economic events. And I think we're beginning to have a deeper understanding as to why that occurs.
Okay, on that, all right, Dennis, I'll give you, no, it's okay. I know Antonio has an important meeting to go to, but I think we have time probably for one more question. So, Dennis?
I was just going to say, you know, it's like the noise in the signal, right? So Congress can often be the noise that doesn't impact the real economy. Of course, it could if it did something blindingly stupid, as Alice suggested they may have the ability to do. But it seems to me one of the bigger problems that we face is the slow erosion of confidence in our markets over time, apart from these particular things in Congress. And so while the markets may not be rigged, as somebody says or somebody doesn't say, and the impact of HFT may be good or it may be bad, it seems to me there's a lack of confidence that government officials, policymakers, and regulators actually know what's going on in the market. And while I think this is an absolutely terrific report, a great public service, and everybody should read it, one of the underlying concerns that screams out is the lack of information, never mind real time, even after the fact, that policymakers and regulators have about what's going on in the markets. And I think the problem with that is that, of course, it results in greater surprises more often. Surprises are what are going to kill confidence over time of investors and market participants. And so I wondered if both of you would comment. Were you surprised at the lack of data and information that you had real time, and even the lack of data information that you could get after the fact?
I was very surprised at how difficult it was to get the data, and I was surprised that the data that we didn't have. In fact, I thought at one point I was thinking that it might be possible to release the October 15th report on October 15th of the next year.
Antonio, do you want to add anything?
Dennis, you're confirming something I said at the end of my remarks, which is that, you know, we need better access to data across agencies, and we need something that approaches real-time access to data. We worked well and diligently and intensively, looked at billions of trade transaction data, order book information, but this needs to be more readily available to authorities.
Okay. Thank you both very much, and thank you all.